to start off the show. And then let everybody know Brian will not be with us today because he is actually on vacation up in Colorado. So I hope he's enjoying the good weather. And hope he's enjoying the good weather up up in Colorado, and he sent me a couple good pictures. So we'll be without him today, but he'll be back for the next one. Let's first start off with a couple updates. We're going to show a couple screenshots here. And we're also going to show a few things that's been added to the website in the last few days and the last week. So let's go ahead and kick off with that. Okay. At ProdigyFK.com, website, like I say, has been updated with a few spots. Definitely want to point out the spot on here for people that help us with our calls and make donations to ProdigyFK.com. For those that have donated, your name appears on the wall as some of our people that has gave donations to us. And let's go over here to the store tab. Something that just came out that was put out just last weekend. For those that do not know, we just had a conference in Olney, Illinois, and the conference videos are now available for purchase. There are 18 episodes with David Denton, Mal Hyman, Casey Quinlan, Ryan Jones, Pete Hymans, Robert and Janet Groden, Gary Shaw, Ed Tatro, Shauna Willis, Larry Rivera, Brian Edwards, Dr. John Newman, myself, Randy Benson, and Brooks LaPlante. The total runtime is 18 hours. This is in MP4 format. It is sold on a USB flash drive. The cost of it is $50. That includes your shipping and handling in the lower 48 states. Other locations of shipping will be at a higher price in case it needs to go overseas or up to Alaska or Hawaii. But you can purchase those. It was a really great conference. A lot of good information was shared. We also have other things that you can purchase on the website, such as the On the Right Side of History, which has a total of, let's see, it looks like about, I think it's, well, if I do my additions correctly, it looks like about 35 hours of film footage. In the Eye of History, the Gathering Director's Cut is 9 hours. That includes interviews with Dr. David Mantic, Jim Jenkins, Paul O'Connor, Jim Seibert, Dennis David, Gerald Custer, and William Law. Yes, the 2020 Global JFK Virtual Conference that we did, those are just about ready to be put out for sale as well, including the 2021 Spring Conference that we did. We also have our two books, Beyond the Fence Line and Blueprint for Murder. We are working on Blueprint for Murder Volume 2. That will be out, hopefully, I would hope it'd be out by November, but we'll see as scheduling happens. I would like to point out now the Shaw Legacy tab. There has been an update on the Shaw Legacy tab. There's a new part here at the very top on both pages, and it states all photos under the Shaw Legacy tab on this website aren't the property of J. Gary Shaw. Some photos are copyrighted and for viewing only on ProdigyFK.com. They are not to be downloaded or reproduced without the express written permission of J. Gary Shaw. Gary's been very kind to let us get into his vaults and to post his negatives and slides that you'll find on the Shaw Legacy 1 tab. On Shaw Legacy 2, the same thing applies, but if you see a download PDF icon that's red and it goes to white when you go on to it, of course, these are able to be downloaded. You don't need any express written permission. They're on there for your downloading pleasure. and you'll find those. I would also like to point out on the affiliated website page, we have added two new sites that you'll find here at the bottom called Quick Hits. This is Doug Campbell's sites, and also the Dallas Action Podcast. If you have not checked these two sites out, they're really good sources of information. He has a lot of great guests on here, and it's worth a click to go on here and to check them out. And all you have to do on any of our links is just click on the photograph, and it will take you directly to that page. Now, I'm going to stop share on that, and I'm going to come up with something else here that I want to talk about. Give me just a quick sec. We've got Larry Snaff in the audience with us today, and I want him to, we're going to talk about this here in just a couple minutes, but this is an article that was just published, and Larry sent me an email with it. This was at the end of April. JFK assassination records, lawyer sues National Archives working on a complaint against Biden. I'm not going to go into the full details of the article, but you can find this on the Project JFK website. If you'll go over to, you'll go over to projectjfk.com, click on the blog section. Click on the blog section, and the first thing you're going to come up to is information from Larry Snaff. And if you look at the JFK Records Lawyer Sues National Archives PDF, you can download that and read the copy. But like I say, Larry's going to be talking about that here just as soon as I turn it over to him. Something else that's in the news, I feel like we're doing a current events tab here. But the other thing that I feel is important is this is from the Chicago Sun-Times, and we I don't know how many people are friends with Abraham Bolden on Facebook, but this was just released. Biden pardons Chicago and Abraham Bolden, first Black Secret Service agent on the White House detail. If you have not had an opportunity to know Abraham Bolden's story, Echoes from Dealey Plaza is his book. I think it's a very good book. You can usually actually read it, depending on how fast of a reader that you are. You can read it in about a day and a half. But this this just came out. He's been wanting to have a pardon for quite some time, for decades. And President Joe Biden on Tuesday pardoned Abraham Bolden. Now, this was Tuesday back at the end of April. But if you have not read the article, it's a good article. It's a fight that's been going on for Mr. Bolden for quite some time. And I know I've saw on his Facebook page lots of people congratulating him, and I am trying to see if we can get him. I sent a Facebook Messenger message to him because I do not have a email directly or a phone number. I did sit down and did a interview with him at a JFK Lancer conference back when his book first came out, and he was gracious enough to sit down with me, and of course I have that interview. It's not the best of quality at that time. I had to use a backup camera. But the story is there. And if nothing else, I will try to get the audio version of it uploaded onto the website and YouTube so you can hear it. But his story is one of betrayal of the government, putting him in prison and served quite a few years. He finally got out, and he's been wanting to get a pardon since that time. And now I guess it has finally happened. So congratulations to Mr. Bolden. But definitely, if you get an opportunity to read that, or if you guys already know about it, that's great. But I just wanted to talk about it here. Let me see here. Larry, let's go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Snaff. And he's going to talk about that article that was written and what he is up to. So, Larry, go ahead and take it away. Nope, your microphone's on mute. Or maybe your microphone's not working.
Can you hear me now?
There we go. Go ahead.
Okay, I didn't have something plugged in. So, as you may or may not remember, I filed a lawsuit against the National Archives, not asking for the actual assassination records, but asking for the memos and emails amongst the agencies and the Office of the Executive, becoming known as the President, that were exchanged in connection with the releases, the decision of President Trump and President Biden to withhold from further disclosure of the records. This was my attempt to backdoor into finding out what is being held and why. The government settled the case in February. They identified 5,700 pages that are relevant to my request, and has agreed to start sending me document dumps every month. The first month, I got they're supposed to give me 250 pages. I got about 79. They were still waiting for other agencies to respond. The second dump at the end of April was 1,159 pages. All of 30 were basically a spreadsheet. I don't know if there's anything interesting in the spreadsheet. I'd be happy to let Joe Box take a look at it to see if there's anything there that is on the spreadsheet that is not currently in the collection.
Yes, please.
Okay. And included within the two dumps were some interesting memos between the National Archives, the CIA, and the FBI. Apparently, the FBI was the more interesting one. Now, remember, these are memos back and forth between the agencies discussing the agencies, the FBI and CIA's request to postpone further disclosure. So these are not documents that are in the collection. These are emails and memos. Now, some of the actual documents were redacted in whole. So like the underlying, say, memo that maybe was articulating the draft order, Trump's draft order, before it was finalized. That has been completely blacked out. We are going to object to that redaction on the grounds that the JFK Records Act is much broader than the Freedom of Information Act. So they made objections under the deliberative process exemption from FOIA. But we have, I found the CIA memo from 1999, Office of General Counsel, which concurs that that exemption and the attorney-client privilege are not grounds for postponing records under, it's not grounds for objecting to release of records. The JFK Records Act is broader than the Freedom of Information Act. Anyway, the FBI apparently, so these records so far that I have, they're sending me them chronologically. So right now I just have information about the October 2017 postponement from Trump. So the next batch I anticipate will start talking about the April 2018 postponement. But apparently the FBI was objecting to the release of 6,040 records relating to the mafia, which is a little interesting. The CIA was also objecting to the release of several thousand documents, principally on the grounds that they would disclose names of agents or people that work for us overseas. So the memos are interesting because the National Archives is objecting to the objections or disagreeing with the objections of the agencies, the grounds they use. And what appears to have happened was you know, I have to give them credit. They really tried, but they didn't have the power of the ARB. The ARB had the power to overrule the objections. NARA doesn't, but they tried their best to push back. They were pushing back in middle of September, and then a decision was made that they need more time to resolve the outstanding issues. What also is apparent is that, or it's not obvious because I don't have the actual draft documents, but it looks like as the order, the Trump, first Trump order postponing 6 months, it looks like it evolved so that the order was done at the request of NARA, not by the agencies. In other words, they put the archivist in the position of asking the president to postpone because it needs more time, as opposed to what was really going on was what NARA was trying to get the CIA and FBI to release the records, and they kept saying no, and then they punted to the president, and instead of the president making a decision, they turned around and asked NARA to say, I need more time. So we kind of knew a little bit what was going on because Government Attic had gotten this a legal memo from the Department of Justice providing advice to the president. So I'm actually going to be really interested in seeing how they dealt with the 2018, April 2018 postponement. So that's where, so I'm getting document dumps at the end of each month. I suspect the next document dump for April is going to be similar to the one I just got, where most of the dump is going to be a spreadsheet of the records that are being postponed. So, you know, like of the last dump of the 1159 I got, I think 30 pages involved memos and emails. And then at some point, we're going to go to the court and object to the redaction of the underlying documents, because I want to see if there, you know, they were redacted on the grounds that it was a deliberative process. They were working on an order, but under the JFK Records Act, that's not grounds for objecting. I'm happy to share the memos, if anyone wants them. They're, you know, it's just the, National Archives telling the FBI that it disagrees with its objections. For example, the FBI was saying, well, you know, we have all these mafia investigations, and the archive says, well, these people are dead. There's no ongoing investigation. And they use very generalized objections. They weren't actually using the grounds in the JFK Records Act. And so another problem at the CIA was that they were using different standards to make this decision. Now, interestingly, I got hold of a memo that Jim Johnston had written when he was at the Church Committee. It was a memo to Gary Hart. This is an illustration of the problem we're facing. So the one that's in the collection has redactions. But then there's a separate document for the same memo with a different RIF number that doesn't have the redactions. So it just shows you that within the agency, you have multiple reviewers looking at these documents, and they're applying different standards. So Jim Johnston gave me his version of the memo where the redactions, it had a different number, and the redactions were not there. There was a full release, and the redacted material was like where the meetings took place, like in Brazil, where the source was. There was a document that talked about, the content was about Oswald in Japan. There was nothing in that document that was not, that we don't already know. The reason it was withheld all this time was because we had a listening station in Australia, and the Australians did not want us to reveal that we had a listening station on their soil. That was the ground that document was held for 60 years. I guess finally the Australian government said it's okay, 60-year-old issue. So that's where we are on the production from the settlement. I suspect we're going to have litigation about the redactions, because my argument, we never got to argue this in court because the government settled, perhaps the reason they settled, was that any correspondence about an assassination record is an assassination record, and therefore it has to be governed by the Records Act and not by the Freedom of Information Act. So we'll see how that goes. The second issue is our complaint against Biden. I have set a deadline of Sunday for pencils down. So we've had some people making last minute edits to the document. We will finalize it this coming week. We're then going to send it off to Mary Farrell. We'll see if they will agree to be the plaintiff. If they don't want to be a plaintiff, then I have someone else that potentially could be a plaintiff. And we intend to file that next month. The final piece of news is I have a letter that's going to be sent to Carolyn Maloney requesting oversight hearings on the JFK Records Act. I've delayed sending it to her because I've been getting some interesting signatories to the letter. John Tunheim has agreed to sign it. And I've also gotten a number of open government or transparency organizations to sign it, including the UVA Center of Politics, Larry Sabato's group, the National Security Archives, Open the Government, and a few others. And I'm still working on some others. I want to get as many historic or nonprofit organizations signing up to sign this letter to make it more effective. There was some of you might know that in October, five representatives had sent a letter to President Biden asking him to release all the records. Three of those congresspersons in April again contacted him asking him for a meeting to discuss the JFK Records Act. I sent an email to each of those representatives this week, giving them a copy of the letter, the draft letter to Maloney. I asked them either would they sign the letter or perhaps more importantly, contact her and ask her to hold an oversight hearing. So we'll see how that works out. There was another letter I sent to, in connection with this request, to David Ferraro, who was the archivist, asking the National Archives to follow up on the numerous outstanding information requests that have been in effect since 1998. So when ARB went out of business, it had some final recommendations. There were outstanding information requests at that time, and many of them are still outstanding. So we asked the archivist to follow up, and one of the things we're asking for is to have the court in Texas unseal the tapes of Carlos Marcello, who allegedly confessed to an informant who was his cellmate that he was behind the planning of the Kennedy assassination. We have a transcript, I believe, but we really want to hear how he said this to see whether he was just bullshitting or whether this seemed genuine. It was sealed by the court, and I think that was in the mid-80s. That was part of the Cantex sting operation. And there's a history behind that, which I'm happy to share. And then Jim Johnston finally got, he's been trying to get some materials from Mexico. And he got some materials from the Mexican government finally this past week. He shared them with me. They're also available on his website. He's the one that wrote Murder, Inc. Now, he believes that Oswald either was working for or was working under the impression that he's working for Castro. He believes that Oswald killed Kennedy and that Castro may have been behind the assassination, or at least got Oswald to do that. So we disagree on the theory, but there's lots to work with him on in terms of documents and information. So I've been working with him. His book has some really fascinating documents that he's uncovered. You know, he was staff attorney for the Church Committee. He actually helped write Book 5, the Gary Hart and Schweikert book. So he has lots of institutional memory, and I've oftentimes talked to him about things that happened, what he recalls. So the Mexico, the records that were released by the Mexican, part of the Mexican government, there's still some other documents that are not released. And so we haven't asked, as part of my letter to David Ferraro, to have this, the archives contact the Department of State to follow up on getting the rest of those Mexico records. Some of you might know that David Ferraro has retired from the National Archives. President Biden has to nominate a successor. But I've also learned from this exercise going through the records that the archivist isn't really the power person at the at National Archives. It's the chief operating officer. So all communications at this point going forward, I'm going to be directing to the chief operating officer who is remaining there. The archivist is really the person that is overseeing the actual archive collection. The National Archives is an agency, and they have a chief operating officer. It's an independent agency, so it's not like an administrator or secretary. His title is chief operating officer. So that's been interesting. I think that's it, David. I'm happy to take any questions or.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to say that's very interesting about the mafia stuff that they don't want to release right now. And I understand it's a court case. If there's any memos that you would like to share that we can post on the Larry Snapp section of ProjectJFK.com, please forward those to me. And if you can name them or put them in order of how they should be posted, that would be great. Absolutely, we want to put that out there.
Okay, yeah, I mean, they're public records at this point. They're being disclosed. So I'll send you the memos from the archivist, from the National Archives to, you know, discussing their objections to the objections.
Okay, yeah, I think that'd be great, and that way we can put it out there for anybody that wants to take a look at that. I know Joe seems to be very interested in that. Does anybody have any questions for Larry? Well, Larry, you're doing great work. Thank you for the update, and you know, keep up the fight, and you know, keep checking in with us. And you've always got a speaking spot here on the show to let us know what's going on the legal basis.
One thing I forgot to mention: we are actually zeroing with the assistance of Doug Horn on the Oswald tax information. So we're also asking. As part of the ask, we want Congress to revisit that issue. You know, those are considered assassination records, but they're withheld in full. So, I get a sense something is going on about that, but I'm not privy to it. But we're definitely, put that in the letter, the draft letter to Maloney. And if anyone has, and I'm thinking about Casey in particular, if anyone has contacts with any historical associations or organizations. You know, I want to get as many of these organizations to sign this letter as possible. So if you have any contacts, you know, like, for example, when I went to the National Securities Archives, the chair of their board, his wife actually worked for Fenstowell. So they were very interested in this topic. So, and then they have other connections, they connect them with other. So I'm just trying to get more and more connections. If anyone has contacts with any historical organizations, you know, association of historians, whatever they are, I don't even know what there's out there. Any open government groups, like, say, I don't know who to contact at Government Attic, for example. So if you have any contacts, please let me know so I can reach out to them. What I do is I give them a copy of the letter and say, would you be happy to sign this? Can we add your name to it? And we're trying to get organizations because they represent lots of people, right? As opposed, we have lots of individuals. And I also just got Jonathan Marshall, who's written a great book on the mafia called The Dark Quadrant. And it's an eye-opening book about how the tentacles of the mafia really penetrated into the highest levels of our federal government. I always knew it was on a local government level, but it's amazing. And he's got a lot of stuff there about the Kennedy assassination. So, you know, I am now beginning to believe personally that Carlos Marcello was the one behind this. And whether how he associated with some of these rogue elements of the CIA, with the way they were working together, you know, whose side everyone's on, but I'm beginning to lean towards, from what I've all read now, it's looking like he was the man maybe that was the brains behind this plot, and then maybe it was executed by people that are expert at executing people. But anyway, that's an aside. But that's why I was really interested that the FBI held back its entire La Cosa Nostra files.
Well, yeah, absolutely, Larry, and you know, great information. So,
quick question, Larry, what do you know of others who are trying to hold Biden and the government to account for these documents? Any other body making the same kind of legal pressure on them?
Not on the JFK issue, but there is a number. There was a hearing last week that Elizabeth Warren was involved in about the level of overclassification. The PIDB, there was a board member that came out and was very optimistic that the Biden order was actually, in his opinion, I think it's a little parsing, but it's going to be interesting to see. He believes that effectively the Biden executive order from October essentially gives NARA the same power that the ARB had. In other words, it puts the burden, if NARA objects like it did in 2017, the only way the agency at that point could withhold the record is to go appeal to the president. Now, that's what the system was up until now. And maybe I think he's thinking it's going to be more specific on a document-to-document basis. But there's an investigation, for example, now into the records that President Trump took to Florida. So there's these little percolating investigations. And there's also, I also uncovered a memo from as part of the historical review group that CIA has. They have to periodically, you know, review their records for declassification. And their standard is very close to the assassinations record. So this might be stuff we're going to use in when we get into our briefing for the complaint, but no one has is focusing on the Biden or Trump orders. We have some standing issues that we're going to have to deal with. I think we have navigated around one of them, but ultimately there's going to be an argument that we don't have the right to enforce the Assassinations Records Act. But we'll deal with that when the time comes. You know, we have lots of lawyers working on this, so we just want to make sure we don't get thrown out of court, you know, on a motion to dismiss. If we can get past that, some interesting stuff may happen.
Thank you.
Leo, yes, the title of the book is Dark Quadrant by Jonathan Marshall.
Okay. Well, sounds good. Anybody else have any more questions for Larry? If not, we're going to move on. I know Casey wanted to talk about a couple quick things. Casey, go ahead. Make sure you unmute your microphone.
How about now?
Yeah, there you go.
You hear me now? Well, first of all, I want to point out to Larry the amount of work that he is doing and the research and the material. I would say from the other level, because most of us aren't lawyers and things like that, but the amount of work and time that he has put in to get us some very, very important information and to get some of these things passed through. And I know you're running into a lot of roadblocks, and hell, we've been running into roadblocks for the past 59 years. But I just wanted to give you an attaboy or a pat on the back, because I'm not sure the government will ever do that. But at the same time, thank you very much, Larry, for what you're doing, and everybody else who is doing things on that level, and that would be with Joe Backus and those individuals. But Larry, from us, thank you very much for what you're doing.
Thank you.
David, I had a little problem getting on here, but at the same time, had you mentioned anything about the Olney connection that we had?
Yeah, I went ahead and let everybody know that we now, one, that we had done the conference last month, and also number two, that the finished videos are now available online to purchase. Our store is not typical. It's not a typical e-commerce site, just because of costs and things. But what we do is you can purchase it by, the quickest way to do it is through PayPal. And we will, we collect the payment through that, email us your mailing information that you want it mailed to. And then as soon as I get that, the payment is processed, then the drive gets shipped out, usually the same day, depending on what time it is. Obviously, if the post office is closed, then it will go out the next morning. But yeah, those are available. And for more information, you can visit the productjfk.com website and click on the store tab, and you'll find the information, to get a hold of one of those.
Yeah, David, I also wanted to point out for those people who got an opportunity to see the presentations, I wanted to point out basically that obviously Project JFK and David Denton's JFK Historical Group worked hand in hand as quickly and as rapidly as we possibly could in order to try to present something without it looking like it was just off the cuff. But you guys know as well as I do, trying to put something together like this especially it was off the cuff. But at the same time, we had to have some backing, some money behind that, and we got that from David Denton and Olney Central College and some of the organizations that actually presented him grants so that we could put this conference on. At the same time, we felt it was necessary to try to put something on because of the idea that COVID has stopped us from meeting in person on a lot of different avenues and a lot of different venues as well. But at the same time, we said, well, let's try it and see what happens. And we put on a pretty darn good conference in a short period of time. And it was a 2-day conference, as a lot of you do know. And we had some very, very good speakers in there, and we found out some new information. But it seems to me that every time that there is a conference or a confrontation like some of the things that we're doing right now, we do find some interesting information that some of us haven't covered yet. And there are new books out there, and God forbid, I can't read them all, but I guarantee you I've ripped apart so many dang books, it's unbelievable. I do want to point out that talking to Gary Shaw almost on a daily basis, he firmly believes, as well as I do, that there is enough material information out there on Roscoe White. And I know a handful of you don't believe that the Roscoe White story. But we had Shauna Willis come together in this situation last week. And I think if you look at what her father is, and I know everybody wants documentation on her father, and I'm not really sure if we're going to get some of this documentation. And I'm not sure where the documentation would come from unless somebody has some inside information inside National Security Agency, CIA. And to me, I would guess, educated guess, that a lot of those files have seen the Oval filing cabinet. But at the same time, little by little, some of this stuff is starting to creep out. And hopefully it creeps out before a lot of us die off. And I know a lot of us here are working diligently trying to get, trying to keep up and abreast of what is going on. But Shauna Willis came forward, and she has one hellacious story, and her story coincides with what Roscoe White's story was, is that he was on the grassy knoll that day, the north grassy knoll, and he was one of the shooters that was shooting at President Kennedy. And that where these two people coincide is and Gary brought this information out that Roscoe turned and he was to hand his rifle off to the gentleman on his right who was filming. Well, and then the person on his right who was filming behind the fence was to give his camera and film to Roscoe White. And then Roscoe White, those of you who don't know, he was in the photography department at the Dallas Police Station, and we assume, because we don't have any documents or anything on this, is that he took it over there to have that film produced and then passed it on. But we don't know that for a fact. But where they come in contact is that Shauna Willis said that her father worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence, and that he was assigned to film the murder of John F. Kennedy down there. And he questioned as much as he could without getting slapped in the face or getting fired. Well, he turned around the next day on November 23rd and retired from the Office of Naval Intelligence. And he was one of their, at least according to the documentation that Shanna has put out, one of the top photographers of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, as well as the Office of Naval Intelligence. Now, to again, trying to get this information out is pretty tough, trying to get it documented. But she said that her father was to pick up the rifle from the Dallas policeman who was shooting at the president and confiscate that. I don't know where he put it, but we have people who were seeing from behind the picket fence on the grass. You know, we have interviewed several people that said that he took it over to a car and put it in the trunk of a car. Okay, well, you know, the Dallas police don't have that. We don't have documentation on that. So we're going on hearsay. And the bad part of hearsay is that, my God, we can make up stories too. I mean, I could say that, hell, I was shooting from the sixth floor window of the Texas School Book Depository building at age 13. Don't even try to investigate that, for God's sake, please. But at the same time, that's where we get a crossover there between Shauna Willis and Roscoe White and Ricky White. And what we're finding out, again, it's hard to document this, but we're finding out from sons and daughters of some of these people who have finally come forward and basically said, this is what my father told me, this is what we think happened. And it coincides with Roscoe White and what Ricky White said about his father. And I can tell you, Gary Shaw's sentiment is that, you know, and I asked Gary this, I said, why do you think Roscoe White was murdered? And he says, well, he thinks in 1971, Roscoe found God. And by finding God, he decided that he wasn't going to kill any more people and that he was going to confess not only to his minister, and that's what Gary thinks got him killed. And so before he actually died, basically, he's saying that you will find information about what I've tried to tell the minister. You'll find it. And when you do find this information, a lot of doors will be open. But I think when Ricky found that information, the doors began to shut down because he didn't know who to go to, and he ended up with the FBI. And jokingly, I would turn to Gary and say, you know, if you want anything lost, so you can't find a damn thing, just give it to the FBI. It's one of those things that we can laugh at, but at the same time, once we have access to some files, even if they're redacted to a certain extent, as several of our lawyers have said, especially Larry, the idea that there's still information there, and we need to see what that is, even if some of those things have been redacted. But I just want to point out that there is new information out there, until we can kind of confirm that, it's tough to do. Recently I've been corresponding with Larry Rivera, and Larry Rivera, I know Larry's online. I'm going to turn it over to him in a few minutes, but we've been really talking about Scorzini, the Scorzini papers, and also the coup in Dallas. And I realize that basically, for the most part, we are looking at the very possibility that these individual people, such as Scorzini, may have been involved in the murder of JFK. Now, again, if we were to go to a court of law, I mean, this becomes hearsay, and it becomes interpretation. And as a teacher, one of the things that I used to do all the time was to present as much information as I possibly could. I would bring my own documentation into the classroom, and then I'd say, look, as you students are listening to me speak, you have to understand that it is my interpretation. So it becomes a Quinlanism type situation. And I said, you don't have to believe what I say, but I'm presenting this material out so that you can actually see that there is more to this story than what meets the eye. And here recently, and I'll turn this over to Larry Rivera here, some documentation that Larry found, and it talks about Scorzini and about the Madrid connection. So let me see. Larry, are you still on? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm unmuted.
You got it, buddy.
Well, I must say that, first of all, I want to say hello to, you know, all of our colleagues. We haven't seen each other since Olney. And those who want to know where Olney is, it's right in the center of the nation, you know, and there aren't, the closest airport is 2.5 hours. But anyway, we had a very, very good time, and like Casey was saying, very informative. You know, it's very important to interact every now and then. And with the pandemic, we haven't been able to do that. And fortunately, you know, now things are starting to loosen up again. And it's very important because, and I need, like Casey and I have been speaking, and Mayor Ralph Gannis is the author of the book that you can see there on Casey's desk. And it came out in 2018. And I must say that this is the reason why research needs to continue, because the documents from the Scorzini papers were locked away for a long, long time in Spain, you know, with this family, the name of the family, Pardo. And when Scorzini died in 1975, the entire collection went to his wife, his widow. And since they had these close ties there in Spain, where Scorzini established himself in the early 50s, the documents had not been interpreted. So in 2011, Ralph Gannis was able to get a hold of these documents at auction, and he began the slow process of interpretation. And Casey, if you want to jump in here, you know, at any moment, whatever, you know, you want to comment or whatever, but it just so happens that at the same time going on right now, there is a special on Netflix on Scorzini. You know, the serendipity here, it's just unbelievable. And when you combine that, it's in Spanish, but it has subtitles. When you combine the books, you know, with the information that's there on Netflix, we start to get a very, very clear picture here of the capability, not only the capabilities of Scorzini, but his close ties to not only the CIA, but to Dallas and Texas Oil. You know, so when this happens, now you have this nexus going on, and now you have, he falls into the sphere of influence of LBJ, and now we're starting to get some, I wouldn't say definitive, but they are very, very close to what could have happened. You want to say something, Casey?
Yeah, the idea is that I know we're, a lot of people will say we're pretty far reaching on the Scorzini papers as well as the coup in Dallas, but I do know that the documents being the let me see, it would be the it'd be the desktop reference and journal in Coon, Dallas is what was that question as to whether it was authentic. And it's my understanding that it has been authenticized, and that will soon come out. But basically, what does that mean? Well, you have Al Borelli, who's the author of that book, with two other co-authors, and it is basically his interpretation of breaking down what that journal actually means. And as most of you know, over the years, we've had to break down all different types of code names and names that, and then later on we found out what some of these code names were, in military terminology as well as, CIA, FBI terminology. Things like, for instance, the Secret Service has code names for the president, his wife, and his kids and things like that. And also the car. I mean, you've got Lancer, and you've got Lace, which is Jackie Kennedy, and then you've got the backup cars. Well, anyway, a lot of you know those things, but at the same time, that's some of the material that had to have. Scorzini, Otto Scorzini, he's a war hero for the Nazi Empire, okay, for Adolf Hitler. He was Hitler's number one.
Commando,
yeah, and his job was to infiltrate sections of armies like the United States, Great Britain, and anybody who was fighting against, and the Nazis were going after. But he was a commando. He had all different types of training, and one of those things, well, he was an assassin. And as for some of his greatest advances. And that he's well known for. He's well known for saving the life and freeing
Benito
Mussolini, and he got a whole bunch of praise for that from and awards for that by Adolf Hitler and Eisenhower even basically felt that he was one of the greatest commandos that he had ever known or seen. And Eisenhower got to know him later on, but sitting on Eisenhower's desk, which I, you know, you have to read in between the lines, but in between the lines, sitting on Eisenhower's desk in Washington, D.C. as president of the United States is a picture of Otto Scorzini. I find that kind of weird, but at the same time, Scorzini was captured back in 19, in fact, he turned himself in 1945, and the United States government, under the jurisdiction of Dwight David Eisenhower, who was five-star general at the time, and then John J. McCloy, who was the governor, the acting governor of and you're going to find McCloy all through this whole thing. You're going to find Alan Dulles all through this whole thing, William Donovan all through this whole thing. And we're looking at the OSS. We're looking at the Office of Naval Intelligence. We're looking at wartime intelligence agencies, and especially along with the British intelligence, SOE and MI6. And you're going to have these agencies come together in 1944, 1945, and then they're going to meld in together with the Abwehr and some of the agents that are going to be that were used by Adolf Hitler. And we have those agents sitting on the dockets at Nuremberg and Dachau waiting to be tried as war criminals. And Scorzini is probably one of the biggest there, other than the people who politically ran the Third Reich. But Scorzini was their handmaiden. He was the guy that actually committed assassinations. He was the guy that actually took care of. Yeah, anything that they wanted to do.
Well, they were so paranoid about Scorzini that don't forget that they had to hide Ike Eisenhower in Paris for fear that he would come and kidnap What I wanted to show here, and I put this picture up a little while ago, this is a photo that's in the Skorzeny papers, and it's also shown on the Netflix documentary. That's Skorzeny on the right, okay? And to the left, you're not going to believe who are to the left. And they have been identified by Gannis as sitting is Cord Meyer, and the one standing is David Atlee Phillips, all right? So after you guys can bring your jaw back up, you know, after the reaction, that's why I think, you know, we've got the documents are there. And one of the ones that just came out, which was released in December, happens to be an Operation Mongoose meeting of the special group augmented in the sense that Robert Kennedy is in the meeting, is present. And if I can go here once again, and I'll show you what that document is.
Larry?
Yeah.
I just have a brief question. Do we know where that picture was taken of the three of them together?
In a Learjet. No, up in, you know, probably 30,000 feet up in the air. Okay. And I find that picture to be very, very important, very significant. Now, 3 of May 1962, and here's that meeting, and Harvey was controlling all of this, Mongoose and everything. So the report is actually the chairman here was General Taylor. And as you can see, Robert Kennedy, Mr. Johnson, not Lyndon, Roswell Gilpatrick, who we have spoken about many times, General Decker, General Lansdale, obviously we all know who he is, General Craig McCombs, head of the CIA, and Mr. Harvey, William King Harvey. And basically here, on the second paragraph, Harvey is given a rundown on progress to date with agent teams, okay? And in the general field of intelligence, including the Opa-Locka, which is not redacted, but over here it says the Madrid Clandestine Interrogation Center. Well, that was Skorzeny's base of operation, Madrid, Spain. Okay, so this document, believe it or not, and here where you see over here where they were told, whoever was reviewing this, to excise Madrid. Okay, and as far as General Lansdale, his copy of the letter was destroyed 4/9 of 63, okay, April the 9th of 63. And here is the non-redacted version of the document, okay? Now, regarding Skorzeny, let me just briefly go here. May Brussel wrote in 1984, his commando organization for hire was named Internacional Fascista. And she continued, SS Colonel Skorzeny CIA agents participated in terror campaigns waged by Operation 40 in Guatemala, Brazil, Argentina. Skorzeny was also in charge of the Paladin mercenaries whose cover, MC Inc., was a Madrid export-import firm. Now, I want to stress that Skorzeny wasn't a high-level Nazi because he was never associated, you know, with the with the Final Solution, all right? But he was in the know enough that once the war was over, he was in high demand by governments because of what his specialty was, all right? And apparently he continued to build his organization of mercenaries and people that he knew, snipers and people who were able to get things done. You know, for example, I'll give you a paperclip, Operation Paperclip. He's the one that rounded up all the Germans, you know, and identified them for the Americans. So that's how important Skorzeny was. And I think if we could get Gannis on here someday or, you know, establish some kind of contact, because the documents that he has uncovered, he says, they lead to Skorzeny completely. And here is when you buy the book, the very first line paragraph says right here, Mr. Director, and this is some kind of a document that he found, a letter. Only you can clear Otto Skorzeny of the guilt of being an agent in the Dallas operation with the passive complicity of Alan Dulles. So.
And that was a letter that was a letter sent to J. Edgar Hoover. So the FBI had this letter at the time, and that was in, I think that came out in 75, 1975. So,
well, Hoover wasn't director by then.
Yeah, but the letter got to him, and in Dallas, Al Borelli realizes that this is an important letter, at least pointing the finger at Scorzini. So what happens is that Al Borelli goes to France, and he gets a hold of the son of Paul Gluck, and he has all of his father's documents and notes and whatever he has, and he goes, well, yeah. He says, I have copies of the letter, all the letters that my father had written the FBI. And so Al Borelli went through those, and he goes, this is the letter that the FBI said that they lost. And the lost letter was, I believe, in March of 1964. And in that letter, Gluck basically, he names about four or five assassins who are in the book, Coup in Dallas. And he names these assassins that they were assassins of the president, that they were in Dallas on the ground that day, and that he wishes the FBI, along with Alan Dulles, would at least exonerate Otto Scorzini and these people for what they did. And that was the letter that was lost. And to me, lost, hell, I think they just, they either lost it on purpose, and then what happens, you have to go to the source. Well, none of us have the money to go over to France and get this guy. Well, that's what Al Borelli did. He says, well, he has a copy of that letter that he sent to the FBI. And he puts that in the documentation in his book, Coup in Dallas. So that's a first, one of the first four letters that he sent to the FBI. And again, jokingly, I said to Gary Shaw, I said, hell, if you send anything to the FBI, they'll just lose it. I mean, my God, they went down and cut out the concrete marks down there where they said a bullet hit and then shattered up and then hit several of the eyewitnesses down there. And so what does the FBI do? They go down in 64, cut it out, and then they put it in the FBI headquarters. And God forbid that if we would ask where that is, because they've lost that too. What else have they lost? And I'm beginning to wonder exactly, you know, we can go through history books and we can go through documentation and we can say this is what our government is. I'm beginning to wonder if our government actually didn't form itself somewhere in the middle of the 1800s or the 1900s on the Sicilian Mafia. I mean, my God, I'm trying to wonder what is and what is not. And that's hard for me after teaching school for about 45 years. But I think this Scorzini connection and the books that are coming out. And I know a lot of you are going to question the documentation, and that's fine. The problem with that is that I'm not really sure if some of the documentation that's coming out of the government is real. Yeah, go ahead, Larry.
I think Gannis would do a great service if he could at least show and share, because his book isn't very well, it's not referenced at all, okay? But, you know, a lot of those documents, he's talking about 2,000 documents, and he's identified so many of the operatives that worked with Scorzini, and the paper trail leads straight to Dallas and straight to the Russian immigrant community there. You know, he's got flow charts of the operatives, which I have copied and everything. If we got a minute, a second, you know, to look at. But his work is quite impressive. You know, I don't know, you know, where, as everything settles, you know, where, you know, Scorzini is going to fall, you know, in all the suspects, you know, but obviously he's a newcomer.
And not only that, the material information that we have is that Scorzini lived a life of Riley, however you want to look at the life of Riley. And I know that's a 1950, 1960 terminology, but after Larry sent me the CDs looking at the film that they shot about Gorzeny, his time period after being a Nazi and what he did for the next 25 years. I got kind of upset about watching the film because he did live a life, Riley. And I am sitting there thinking, my God, this is a bad guy. I mean, this is a really bad guy.
Yes.
But yet he is flaunting the idea that this is what he did, and he is living that life of Riley. And the life of Riley, to me, wouldn't even come close to what his life of Riley is. It's my understanding that Alan Dulles gave him about 2 to 3 bags of gold bullion that they took from Merkers that was found in caves over there. Now, you know, and there's a lot of stories about that, you know, where it illegally came from where it went. But it's my understanding also that you get a hold of General Donovan and William Stevens, and you look with Alan Dulles and a guy by the name of Hambro. They got together. They went to Panama in the end of 1944-45 and ended up forming a corporation called the World Commerce Corporation. And the World Commerce Corporation legally came in and confiscated the Nazi gold. And where did they put it? Okay. Well, it's my understanding they put it in Chase Manhattan Bank. Okay. Run by who? Okay. Run by
McCoy.
John J. McCloy. And I'm going, my God, guys.
I wanted to also, you mentioned briefly on the Mussolini rescue. For those who don't know, this was not just any rescue. We're talking about a mountain retreat where you could only get up there by cable car. And he and his team of, I think, 10 gliders, we're not talking about parachuting or anything. You know, they sent 10 gliders with 10 men per glider at 6,000 feet, you know, as cold as it is, you know, at that height, you know, at that altitude, and they managed to land in a very small piece of land there outside of the hotel, go in there, get Mussolini, and then they have this little plane ready where it only fit two people, and Scorzeny was 6'4", 220 plus, you know, decided he wasn't going to let, you know, the pilot just take off with Mussolini on his own. He was going to be in the plane, so they risked that, and they were able to take off, land in Rome, and then get Mussolini out of there. You know, that's when he finally, you know, hooked up with Hitler and everything. But that's the type of operation that Scorzeny was capable of, all right? And he ran it, and that's, and there were other instances, you know, like when he was chasing down, he was even recruited by the Mossad to chase down a Nazi rocket scientist who would even dare to go work for Egypt or one of the Arab countries. And he actually, in one instance, he went and met up with the German scientist in Germany, and they kidnapped him, and he disappeared. This was done, Scorzeny working for the Mossad, all right? So there you go.
Well, and a lot of these papers, too, are coming out of the World War II archives, which a lot of those have just been released. And so, and not only are we looking at JFK documents, but we're looking at World War II documents.
Yeah.
And some of those documents will probably never be released, but the ones that have been released point the direction of assassination and capabilities in the direction of Scorzeny. And that, and Scorzeny is then totally connected to the OSS, the ONI, and then later on the CIA.
I know,
here's the thing, too, is that we all want to blame, and I'm not going to say all of us, but there's a tremendous amount of us want to blame the CIA. Well, how about the military? How about industry? How about the military-industrial complex, what Eisenhower was talking about? Well, where in God's name is the military-industrial complex? I can tell you right now, the good majority of the military-industrial complex in 1963, a lot of it was all over the United States. But for the most part, it was centered in Fort Worth and Dallas. And I'm sitting there going, good God. Well, where did that come from? It came from the amount of money that was made by the oil people, and they had tremendous amounts of money. One of the things talked about in Coup in Dallas was a guy by the name of Alger Meadows in 1952. He came to the bank and was talking to several of the officers there, and he basically said, you know, I have all this money that I made on oil. And the bank president at the time looked at him and he says, you got $300 million. Now, guys, this is 1952. $300 million in 1952. I don't know. You want to break it down in 2022
yeah,
terms?
Really?
But they said, you gotta find a way to hide this money because you're going to get taxed on it. Well, what would you like me to do? Well, invest in merchandise. What type of merchandise? Military hardware. So, okay. But you know, here's, you go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I wanted to mention another link to the oil man in Dallas, Byrd, the owner of the TSBD. We all know that at the time of the assassination, he was on a safari in Africa. Well, the person who organized that safari and who ran that company was Otto Scorzani.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I know we have, you know, we're trying to point fingers and we have guilt by association. And at this particular point, other than trying to interpret any of the documents that come out, and God forbid, thank you guys for getting those documents out. I mean, we're to the 59th year and we're still looking for documents. But at the same time, it looks like little by little, maybe some of the ways that we're going to get some of this documentation is, I hate to say it, but like on deathbed confessions. Or we're going to get things that are in somebody else's individual archives. And here's Appendix B in Scorzani's book.
The world, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, and for instance, you look at some of these names here. There's the World Commerce Corporation. Well, Frank Ryan and Ricardo Sacri were OSS officers, okay? One of the key individuals, and we believe this key individual is in Dallas that time, and I believe he's on the ground running cover for the assassins, and that's Jack Crichton. And, Jack Crichton is OSS. The common denominator, I think, of this is military intelligence coming out of World War II. And I think we need to look at if we have access to the military intelligence, whatever is available for us to see that and try to tie that into individuals that are in Dallas and Fort Worth. And the Safarilandia, Werner yeah. von Alvensleben. Okay, I was doing some research on this gentleman, and I told Larry, I said, the guy is 6'4". Werner von Alvensleben is 6'4". He weighs 220 pounds, and he has a scar. He has a scar from a sword
right.
across his face. And I'm looking at that. I'm going, who the hell is that? If you look at Scorzani, that's exactly what Scorzani has, unless there's two people. But at the same time,
yeah.
And so, and then Larry did the research on this. He's 6'4", 220 pounds. I mean, he's a big guy, and not only that, he's a bad guy.
Well, one of the things also that I noted and I in the Scorzani papers is we've been talking and you have been doing so much research on QJ Wynn, all right, and we've been kicking it around, Swetra, you know, the connection and everything, the French, but they've always looked at QJ Wynn as an individual, not as an organization. Okay, and what Gaddis is proposing is that it's an organization and that a lot of these Scorzani papers they coincide with movements of QJ Wynn at the same time, you know. So he's found cross-referencing documents that point back to QJ Wynn. I thought that was very interesting as well.
And not only that, when you get into Mary Farrell, and Mary Farrell will break it down, and it's not just Mary Farrell, but it's the researchers who brought this in, the QJ Wynn, which is a CIA, I'm trying to think of the name, but it's a
cryptonym.
Yeah, it's a cryptonym, and QJ basically stands for Madrid. And I'm sitting there going, Well, then is QJ the cryptonym for the program that is coming out of Madrid, and who's running that program? Well, when you start putting two and two together, WIN becomes a code name for maybe an organization like Larry said, or an individual, or a set of individuals who could be trained as assassins to pick from, and then go ahead and say, this guy's QJ WIN. And I do remember,
That organization chart you just showed, where is that from?
That's from the Scorzani papers.
That's okay.
Yeah, it's two pages. It's copyrighted. That's why I don't want to show it too much, but you know, whatever.
And is it what's the other appendix show?
There's B, and that, can you see that A? I just switched to A. You got that?
Okay. Yeah, I see that. Okay.
All right.
And these are
one is the timeline. One is like the timeline. The other one is the individuals and organizations.
And this is a published. This is a book, or these are papers.
No, it's a book. It's a book.
A book based on the papers.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. He obtained them in 2011, and it took him. He published in 2018, so he worked 7 years on the book.
Okay. Thanks.
All right.
And I know Joe Backus is saying, if I'm spelling it right, QJ / WIN, it'd be a QJ. And in some cases, there is no / but in a couple cases, it's QJ / WIN. Just one.
And so I
know Gary Shaw was on this, back in the 1970s, trying to find out who QJ WIN is. And at least according to these two books, QJ WIN seems to be an operation or an organization or an individual or a group of individuals that could be used to commit murder.
You know, and for all we know, QJ WIN could change from one project to another, from one operation to another, you know, the actual QJ WIN. Yeah, the WI Rogue was also, of course. Yeah,
good point. I'm reading a book several years ago about the possibility of where these names came from, and I'm trying to think who said it, but the person who said that I made these names up, like QJ WIN, he said, well, QJ, obviously, right now we know that it stands for Madrid, Spain, but then you get the WIN. He says, well, WIN, I was sitting at the dog track, and I got WIN place and show. And I'm sitting there going, holy cow. I said, well, you know.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that came from, I'm trying to figure out who that came from.
I thought these were computer generated.
No. There are no.
Not back then, I don't think.
No.
But you know, and I hate to say this, but I'll just point out to you my ignorance is that the computer-generated documents, or at least the information that we would use as code names today, are well above my pay grade. The idea that I hate to say this, but I'd have to turn to my grandson for interpretation on what the hell, what are all these codes about? And, you know, a generation, two generations below me has access to that, and I'm sitting there going, I hate to say I'm old, but you know, it's just one of those damn things, and that I don't understand all that, but I do understand some of it, but boy, you know, trying to figure out exactly where all these different code names come from and what happens, and so it amazes me that you, when you get a hacker to hack into something, I'm lost. I'm lost in the sauce, and maybe without the sauce, or maybe I need some sauce.
Let me put this back up here, because I think this is such an important document here on obviously Mr. Harvey, William Harvey, he was the one who ran QJ WIN from the ZR rifle thing, right? And, you know, he is there telling these people, hey, we have this organization in Madrid, you know, and it's very hush-hush, very secret, you know, and here it is. you know, if you want, I don't think you can find a document that, you know, mentions here this with all these people up here, you know. And if that really happened the way it did, then it's, you know, very ironic that this organization here, you know, would be mentioned in the same page of a document with RFK, you know, which indirectly would lead to JFK. So, very ironic.
Yeah, I want to at least pick up these books and show you what some of these books are, just in case you don't know. And here's the Skorzeny papers, and let's see if I can put that up so you can see that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And again, as Larry pointed out, you know, one of the things that I look at in books is I look at the front cover, inside, outside, the referencing. And I know there's some loose things on here that needs to be researched. And you're right. I think we need to get a hold of Gainis and get him in, because he's probably doing some other books on this. But at one time, Gainis, his book on the Skorzeny papers, was working directly with Alberelli. And Alberelli, both of them were going to put out a book. Well, this is Alberelli's book, and Alberelli died before this book came out. Okay? And then... And
Gainis says he's only done about 10% of the documents. He hasn't even done the entire set.
And it's my understanding, Larry, that most of them are written in German.
Yeah,
and
right.
Some of them are in Spanish, but I think most of them are German. So the interpretation on that is we'd have to get somebody that we trusted to interpret that in German. And, of course, I trust you in getting the Spanish translated to me, and I appreciate that.
By the way, I know everybody here has Netflix, all right? And go look for this video and watch it, because I think it's very important.
Well, just so everybody knows, I am in contact. I'm trying to get in contact with Major Gainis to bring him on for a Spotlight series video that, you know, we can have him on, discuss, you know, his background as far as getting the documents, the papers, and also the book itself. So as soon as I can make contact with him and we can get something scheduled, we haven't done a Spotlight series at all this year, just because of everybody's scheduling. But I tell you what, as soon as I can get in touch with him, and if he agrees to it, then I'll put the information out so everybody can attend if we can get him in for a Spotlight meeting. But I think it would be a good thing, instead of just doing a jury meeting, you know, having for a, you know, 2 or 3 hour event.
Yeah, and David, again, I'm going to point out this book. It's called the Skorzeny Papers, and it's a very good book to read. Let's put it this way. It's a minor difficult book to read until you get to this book. When you get to this book, it's going to turn a lot of people off, and I'll tell you why. It is very in-depth, and it is not for the let's say the run-of-the-mill person who says, you know, I'd like to study more about the JFK assassination. You don't want to study this book because you have no idea what they're talking about. So I would say the researchers who know enough about any information that comes out of this will be able to parallel this with something. But Coup in Dallas is a very, very good book. I've read it twice. And then I got this information from another one of our individuals online here, and this is called It Didn't Start with JFK, and it's a double volume, and it's by a guy by the name of Walter Herbst. And I can tell you, as a teacher, this book reads very well. It reads in line, and it goes back to the 1920s, and it says, you know, it didn't start with JFK. It sets the basis for all the operations and units that are going to take place in the Skorzeny papers, and as well as Coup in Dallas. So this is where I'm at in this book, and that's volume one. And it's a piecemeal thing, because I'm trying to break it down and trying to piecemeal these together with these other two books. What was it? I went to a funeral the other day and ran into my old high school girlfriend. Hadn't seen her in 50 years. And she goes, what have you been doing? And I said, well, I've been doing research on the murder of JFK. And she looked at me and she goes, oh, you still doing that? I said, yeah, and he's still dead. okay? It just really pissed me off, for God's sake, you know? But this is what we have to deal with, and you guys know that. I don't need to tell you that, but it's kind of like you grow up and get a goddamn life. Well, I didn't tell you what I said to her, and I didn't say it to her, so. Anyway, Larry, you understand what I said, so. If I need to call a lawyer, I'll call you. There's Snap, yeah. But, yeah, guys, those are some books that we're reading right now, and it looks to me like this book by Jonathan Marshall, The Dark Quadrant, it looks like it might be a pretty good book. And I haven't had access to see that yet, but I'll take your word on that, Larry, and I'll see if I can get a hold of that.
Patrick McCarthy's the one that clued me in on it. So he's done a lot of work. And it kind of shows you how if the mafia was involved, it explains how Hoover was very compromised because he had a ponies problem.
Yes, he did. Yes.
And he actually went to the ponies on November 23rd before he spoke to LBJ.
Yeah, like QJ Wynn, QJ Place, and QJ Show, right?
He apparently, Frank Costello used to complain about having to fix races.
Right, right.
For
$2 bet.
$10 bets, yes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he would have Tolson be the one that, you know, placed the bet. And obviously the other stuff everyone knows about. And even Garrison.
Mary.
Used to go to Las Vegas to get free weekends.
Yeah.
You know, so Marcello was a really smart guy.
I want to throw this out there. I know we talked about it in the last meeting. For those of you, that would like to, submit your book reports, that's what you want to call them. Basically it's review. Review/book report of books that you're reading in your research, that would be, I know I had a person that attends with us, ask me specifically about A Coup in Dallas. Is it a good book to get? Is the information in there, worth sitting down and reading it and purchasing it? That's where, as a community, we can come together to help each other out by knowing what the hell are in these books. It's not just reading the back cover and making a decision on that. Plus, it also helps out the younger researchers of, what books to get a hold of. So, again, anybody that wants to submit writings in, I'll post them up on the website in the blog section, with the picture of the cover of the book, and you'll get full credit for your writing, but it would be a way to get people to grab these books and get them out there to figure out what they need to start reading.
What's the backstory on the author?
Which one?
Gaines?
Yeah.
Well, he was in the Army, right?
Air Force retired.
Yeah, Air Force.
And what did he do for the Army?
Air Force.
Air Force.
He reached major, so.
It was an
officer, yeah.
He was involved in U.S. intelligence.
He was an interesting guy. I got a chance to film him at the JFK Lancer conference in 2018.
He was there?
Yeah, he was there. He spoke, unfortunately, he spoke Sunday morning, so he didn't have a large audience, but he was one of our first speakers that day. And his PowerPoints were a little on the lacking side, but, I told him that. I said, the person you need to hook up with is Casey, because Casey had already read the book once. And then when I met him and he gave his presentation, I got a copy of his book, and then I came home and read his book and started knowing what, just following along what the hell Casey was talking about.
Casey's PowerPoints are very dense.
Yeah, you put Casey's PowerPoint.
Come on.
Yeah, you put Casey's PowerPoints together with any author's, as long as he knows the topic, he's got a PowerPoint for it.
Yeah.
He makes some damn good PowerPoints. That's why I follow his,
that, Larry. That's good. Dance.
Well, your PowerPoints are like reading a book review.
Yeah, they are. Well, What was it down in Olney?
Very colorful.
Yeah, well, you know, Gary Shaw and there's a couple other professors there said, you know, why don't you just make a book out of every one of your PowerPoints? I came home to my wife and she says, so how many books do you have that you can make? And I said, probably about 180. She goes, oh, what, you want to sell those? She goes, we could probably make some money on this. Of course, you know, my wife is, you know, I'm the one I give the money to and then she spends it.
Well, you can make each one a chapter. You have a large,
you know, I thought about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, his PowerPoints are really great. They're just, I will say it. I've said it to him many times. They're just a real bitch when you're trying to do the video editing and you're dropping the individual PowerPoint slides onto the timeline while I'm editing films. But other than that, they're great.
Yeah. you could rival Doug Horn with his.
Oh yes, I'm sure.
Volume.
You know, well, that's what we did with Blueprint for Murder. We each took Casey, Brian, and myself. We took our presentations, put them in a book format, and then included a DVD with the presentations. And well, we did it in my home studio at the time, and that way, you know, you could get you'd have a physical book to read that had the, you know, pictures and stuff. Plus, you had the PowerPoint slides and presentations. So if anybody hasn't, not to throw out a shameless plug, but if anybody hasn't gotten a copy of Blueprint for Murder, Volume 1, it's like I say, it's our first book in the series, and I'm hoping we can put about 10 to 12 books together of volumes where we each, you know, pick a topic and well, not a topic, but we each pick a, you know, a niche of it and, you know, put it together in book form. So,
you know, I'm going to say probably about 8 or 10 years ago, I was at a conference where Joe Backus was giving a presentation. And, you know, Joe, I'm trying to figure out if he's still online. Is he still online?
Yeah, Joe's with us.
Okay. And Joe and I got to talking and he said, you know, you always put out really good, PowerPoints. And I said, well, I'm a teacher. Okay. And as a teacher, that's what I did. And, Joe and I, we haven't gotten together, but Joe really, he puts out a great presentation, but he needs some PowerPoint help. And I told him, I said, we need to get together because I said, you really have some good presentations and some very good material. And I said, I'd like to get with you and then break that down. But, I think what Larry was talking about is the idea that, probably each one of my PowerPoint programs is almost like reading a chapter of a book. And you're right. I need to, as a teacher, I've always been over-prepared and I'm always over-prepared. So.
Well, at this time, I would like to, I'd like to share screen and show a couple quick things before we move on to our free-for-all portion of our show.
You mean we're not there yet?
No, we're not actually there yet, Larry, but we're almost there. So, again, I want to point this out to everybody. The Olney 2022 conference flash drives are available, and Casey Quinlan, his particular topic was the Lancelot Project Part 1 and Part 2, where he goes into in-depth of Scorzani and Coup in Dallas, and then also, we've got Larry Rivera, the Pena de Bruis War. You know, there's a lot of great presentations that were shared over those 2 days. And I'd also like to say the film quality is excellent. The different, I don't know how many people have seen videos that I've produced, but you get the speaker on one side of the of your TV screen or computer screen, whatever you're viewing it on, and then on the right side, you're not looking at a washed out projection screen in person, you know, like what was actually in person at the live taping. You're actually getting the PowerPoint slides broke down into JPEG, so you're seeing everything on the screen, in perfect format. Kind of like how we've gotten used to Zoom when we share screens and we've done our online conferences. That's the way that I film things in person. So it allows you to basically be there at watching it at home. But you get a chance to actually see everything without being washed out or too far away from the screen. So again, anybody that's interested, now I will say this, any speakers that are listed here in the episodes, you are going to get a link from me It's done, and I've sent some out already. I'll be sending out some more later on this weekend. Your presentation that you gave, you'll get a link to download. Please do not share your presentation, your episode online. That's for your personal, you know, collection. Because like I say, we are trying to, you know, sell these, for the people that did not get a chance to attend, or if they did attend and they want to have their own copy of it, these are way better than what you saw on Zoom, if you couldn't attend in person. But like I say, you'll be able to have those, just, you know, point people to the website to let them know, hey, this is where I spoke at, and they have them available. But, you know, please, like I say, don't sell those. Or not sell those, but please don't post those on like social media. While we've been speaking, I just want to let everybody know that
I didn't want to interrupt. I just had a question. Is that available to buy as a download instead of
I was going to put it up on Vimeo, but because of the pricing of Vimeo, they want like $240 a year just to, you know, host, and then they have a amount of time. Or amount of storage you can put online. It was the cheapest of all the ones that I found. And I know that nobody likes to wait on snail mail to have something show up at your door. But unfortunately, because of pricing wise, you'd have to, if you rented it or purchased it on Vimeo, like I know Randy Benson, who filmed one of David's conferences before, he put it up on Vimeo. And, you know, he does other things besides just, you know, JFK stuff, but I'm looking at keeping costs low, and also making sure that it's already, you know, you're not having to worry about, internet speed or anything like that. That's why I've produced them on flash drive, and you can just plug it right in. Some TVs, Blu-ray players, you can plug the flash drive directly in and play from it, or you can put it in your computer, hook that up through HDMI to your TV and watch it on the big screen. You know, we've gotten away from doing DVDs, but, yeah, as far as putting it up online, I obviously I can't do it on YouTube because, of their issues with, you know, to monetize.
Right.
So yeah, that's what we've done now is just like say it comes on a 32 gig flash drive. You get the insert that shows all the information. And then also on that flash drive, there was the conference program. I digitized that, put it in there as a file as well. So, you know, if you showed up obviously in person, you got a copy of that with everybody's backgrounds and biographies. But I went ahead and digitized that and put that on the flash drive as well. So, and they're all split separately. So it's not like just sitting down, plugging it in, you're watching the entire thing. It's all broke up into the different episodes.
Did you put on a separate flash drive, or
what's that?
Did you put Casey's slides on a separate flash drive just to hold the volume? Or?
No, the individual PowerPoint slides, because those are owned by each individual speaker.
I was just joking. It was.
Oh yeah. if anybody is,
you hear me laughing.
If anybody wants to, if anybody wants to purchase Casey's flash drive or his PowerPoint presentations, he does make those available on flash drive. So that way, you know, you can purchase directly from him. And of course, you can always email at projectjfk@yahoo.com and just title it to Casey, and I'll make sure I forward it to him. I'm kind of his secretary that way. But yeah, he makes those available for purchase.
I appreciate all the stuff you do for us.
Well, I want to say something else while the guys were speaking about the Sforzani papers and coup in Dallas. I just uploaded a new video. Now this is from our vault. This is from 1994 when we had the Larry Howard Student Symposium that was filmed in Olathe, Kansas back in 94 at the Holiday Inn. This one episode, it's the only one we've got available right now because we took these off of VHS tapes and digitized. But this has the author Craig Roberts, who wrote Killzone. He also wrote several other good books. He was a Marine sniper. I don't know if anybody knows Craig's background, but a lot of his books are available on Amazon. And this also has Ed Hoffman. You know, in basically both of these are tied together. They're not separate. They're free to view. You can go to projectjfk.com, click on the videos tab, or you can also, for those that have not, for those that maybe haven't, let me get this up on the screen. For those of you that have not subscribed to our YouTube channel, we right now we've got 165 subscribers. I'd like to have a hell of a lot more. But you can find all of our videos from previous events and different programs that we've done on ProjectJFK.com. So, you know, if you would like to, you know, become a subscriber, please do so. For those that are watching this on YouTube in the replay, check out some of our other videos that we have. Hit that thumbs up button, the like, and, you know, leave some good comments for it. And that helps us out by, we don't make any money off of it, but it helps us put, you know, more of a subscriber list together. So that way, once you do subscribe, though, anytime when we upload a video, you're known immediately through your email, hey, Project JFK has posted a new video, check it out. So, you know, that's helpful, not only for us, but also for the research community.
Okay, David, I want to at least point out that back at the Alney conference that we had, that Randy Benson put out a pretty fantastic video, and I want to promote that a little bit to anybody who does go out in the public and wants to give an update about where we were back in 1963 and where we are in 2022. He did this, and it was one of the best presentations I've seen, and it kind of brings you up to date. But at the same time, we all know that there are people like Larry Schnapp that are working real hard behind the scenes, as, you know, as well as several other people that are doing that. Joe Backus is one of them. But at the same time, I just wanted to mention that Randy Benson did one heck of a job in presentation. And it might behoove you guys, if you do go out in public, this would be a good presentation to show the public, you know, where we were and where we are now. So, I mean, it gives you a good, it's kind of a, I know David every once in a while says it's a 101 program at a high school or college. So, yeah.
Yeah, Randy did an excellent job. I know we sat down and had a beer together, and I told him, I said, that was one of the best presentations that you've given. And the reason why, because it's one of those things where, well, one, we were at a college, and to get the, you know, the younger generation involved, it's one of those presentations that kind of gives you an outline of what happened and like Casey said, what was going on back then and where we are today. So yeah, Randy, he did an excellent job on that. And if anybody would like, he's got a Vimeo page. It's called Critical Focus Pictures, and he has a lot of videos on there. And he also has the Olney conference from 2018, 2019. I think it was 2018, I believe is what it was, that he put the videos up there online that you can either rent or purchase. Now, those are digital. As far as I know, he never released them on flash drive like we do, but you can check that out on Vimeo, I think it's Vimeo.com, and it's called Critical Focus Pictures. Randy's also the director that made the movie The Searchers. He's also working on The Searchers Part 2, a update with new, he's starting to collect new interviews to make a second film, so we want to support Randy in his endeavors and what he does for the research community as well.
Okay, last but not least, before I gotta take out here because I've got my grandson duties because he's graduating from high school. But I do want to at least point out a gentleman by the name of Craig Bozarth. And Craig has really done tremendous work for Project JFK. And I just want to give him a hands up, a round of applause for him. So thank you, Craig, for all you've done for our program and enhancing our program. So, but the rest of you guys, argue it out for the next hour or whatever it's going to be. But I'm going to be with my grandson. So you guys take care. And I'm going to continue making videos and some PowerPoints. And I'm going to send them all to Larry Schnapp.
Thanks, Casey. tell your grandson from all of us, congratulations on graduation.
And where does he stand on the assassination?
Let me tell you, I had a hard enough time trying to get him to play some baseball.
Oh.
But more than that, you know, he says, well, Grandpa, he says, I like playing baseball, but he says, I don't see any money in my future with baseball. So he went into music and ended up getting a $72,000 scholarship in music. You're in the right spot, son. Stay there.
Wow.
How about that? And now I just sit back and I go, wow, the heck with baseball.
Yeah.
Very interesting. To me, of course, I'm prejudiced, but at the same time, he can dance, he can sing, and he can play 17 instruments. So I'm sitting there going, wow.
How is he with PowerPoint presentations?
He's probably a little bit better than I am. You know, Larry, here's my deal. I'm going to do a PowerPoint presentation on your life. And I swear to God, if it lasts a minute or 2 to 3 hours, I think you'll just be impressed.
Well, you know that some of the stuff that happened in my frat house would make what happened with what Kavanaugh did pale in comparison to my frat house. That's why I never ran for office, because I just was afraid that somebody would say something about what happened in my frat house.
Yeah, well.
That's why I'm glad none of my frat brothers decided to run for office.
Oh, God, well.
I mean, I have pictures. You know, Kavanaugh had a little, like, notes. I have a diary and I have pictures.
God.
That kind of reminds me of when we were watching All the President's Men, the lawyer, what was his name? I forgot. I can't think of that's top of my name right now. But he goes, "What the stuff we did, you know, back in college was way worse than what we did here. You know, so I can only imagine what Larry did in his younger days."
Wasn't what I did. I was surrounded. I was. My job was to playing Casey. I was the frat historian. So I had to record all significant social events, and you know, anytime something sexual happened, I felt obligated to record it, because for many men, many of my frat brothers, was the first time. So anyway.
Yeah, there we go.
Donald Segretti. Yeah, it's got to be.
Segretti, yes. Okay.
Thank you, Brooks. Yeah, I couldn't think of the name at the top of my head. But
so David, you'll edit the last 2 minutes out, right?
You will see.
Well, I just got to ask you, Larry, do you like beer?
I still like beer.
I like the beer drink.
I got to go, guys. Take care.
All right, have fun.
Thank you, Casey. Well, this now opens up the last portion of our show for the water cooler talk, the free-for-all. So anybody that wants to share what they're working on, you know, now is the time. So,
by the way, I put a post in the chat room. Does anyone have David Ron's email address?
I don't think he's really that active anymore. I can check with some sources, but
probably 90 years old at this point.
Right. Right.
I just want to see if he wants to sign the Maloney letter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier, what happened with the, I don't know what the hell we just saw on the screen, but we had a newcomer. I don't want to say an infiltrator, because everybody's welcome to attend our events, but whoever the TJ or Terry Johnson was, like I say, I don't know what the hell we saw on the screen, but I put him outside the room for a minute, and then he just disappeared. So
I sent an email about that, David. I don't know if you saw it yet, but my comment to you is, considering our recent conversation about Zoom and WebEx security, you have now been officially Zoom bombed. That's what a Zoom bomb is.
Really?
That's what that is, huh?
That is what a Zoom bomb is. And I applaud your quick action and recognition. The only thing you can do is eject the person from the meeting completely. But I can't tell you how many times I've seen this happen. It's unfortunately a vulnerability that Zoom has been dealing with for over 2 years now.
That means somebody needed to have access to the
password and everything.
Right. Yeah.
No, you don't really need the password. It's embedded in the connection link. So anybody who finds their way to the Evenbrite site or other mechanisms, that's why you can't post these things on social media. Because I don't know if you saw it. I saw it, and it was a young kid and another kid dressed up as an animal. And it was usually, it's the same thing as a photobomb. You know, it's intended to be no more than 15 seconds of disruption, and then they go away.
And it was, you know, they had a little axe.
Oh, yeah, and a costume. And
that was,
at least it was in porno.
Oh, that's, yeah, well, that's, we won't talk about that.
That was in Larry's frat house, I think.
Well, it'll definitely be edited out before we post on YouTube in the replay. But for those that appeared live, you got a chance to see it. But, yeah, I mean, I went back and looked on it. They had signed up for an Eventbrite ticket. And they weren't in our – I looked in the email list, and they've never attended our event before. So, of course, anybody that's, you know, scrolling through on Eventbrite, they can see that, you know, they can sign up for an e-ticket and attend. But they were quiet for a little bit, and then they just popped out there. But so Zoom bombing, okay, that's something new on me. We've been going on you know, a little over a year now in our shows. So it was the first time we got hit, I guess. But hey, somebody's taking notice. like I said earlier, everybody's invited to attend, including assholes. So, you know,
this is the challenge, is sort of finding the place with the slider between openness and not openness, where you know, if you go too open and too broad-based, sometimes you invite people who have nothing better to do with their lives. And if you don't, on the other extreme, then you're not accomplishing the open objectives of this forum. So it's a tough call. I made a suggestion. We can talk about it in the email, David. We can talk about it later.
Well, when I do a Zoom call, I send a message directly to recipients.
That's a way, if you know your audience.
Yeah.
But that's my comment, is that Project JFK is intended to educate anybody and everybody who has some time to listen and participate. So when you have a known list, you're a little bit less vulnerable to this kind of behavior.
Well, David, do we actually, so when you go from all the last couple programs, has there been any new people that have logged in except for these characters, or is it basically the same suspects?
We usually on average pick up maybe 1 to 5 people, new. And usually it's because of word of mouth. I mean, somebody that, you know, has been in attendance. They passed on the information, and then we have some new attendees. But I'd say the last probably, I mean, we've grown, especially. I mean, when we first started out doing this, it was, I think there was like maybe, less than 10 of us in the room. And then as the email list has grown bigger, you know, like I say, this guy here, you know, they went on Eventbrite, got a ticket. I've got his email. First and last name, whether the email's bogus or not, it's a Gmail email address. But you know, I'm all for people showing up and hearing what we've got to say, as long as they can be, you know, actually here for the right reason and be respectful. So.
Oh, and by the way, I wanted to add that I've been following. I don't usually do the education forum, and they have some discussions on Sporzeni and Swetra going on there for anybody who, you know, wants to get involved in it. I don't, but it's up there.
Is that the link that you post in the chat?
Oh, no, that's to my blog. But, okay. You know, okay. The education forum, just go on there and, you know, scroll down to JFK assassination debate and you'll find it there.
Right, I would just
add another comment, David. If you do a little checking on that email address and satisfy yourself that it is, in fact, bogus, I can show you how to exclude that from future meetings. You can exclude an email address from participating in your meetings.
Okay, yeah, that'd be a good idea.
Yeah, but, you know, again, you have to sort of go through the due diligence phase.
Right.
Because things, my experience in life is things are rarely as they seem.
Yeah. Well, let's see here. Would anybody like to, the floor is open for anybody that would like to talk and share their information. Joe, are you with us?
I'm here.
I got your email the other day. Is there something that you'd like to share, what you're working on?
Remind me about the email now.
Well, you were just asking, like, you know, did we have a topic or was it going to kind of be a free-for-all?
Oh, right.
You know, we've had some pretty great topics to talk about, but that's usually how our journey meetings last. I mean, they're usually based on the fact of just, you know, getting together and talking about the case. And then the spotlight series is more focused on, you know, one researcher. But, you know, absolutely. I mean, if you've got something you'd like to talk about, you know, the floor is open for you.
Hey, what's up with Bart? I just wanted to ask you real quick.
I got an email or a WhatsApp connection with Bart. I don't know if he just asked me about some stuff I'm supposed to send to him, which that'll be happening. I've told him it'll be happening for quite some time, but I've been kind of all over the place with getting the information to him. But I hope he's not pissed at me. You know, he's always great to have in the room with us. I haven't heard anything, you know, bad. I know he was, you know, kind of taking a little break right before Scream happened, but, you know, hopefully he's doing well. We wish him the best.
I want to circle back with Joe. So I think we've been talking to Rex, and, have you seen any improvements lately with the, online collection for the JFK collection and NARA?
Meaning NARA's own online collection?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
I mean,
does anybody know how their digitizing is taking place? I know they were putting together a team to digitize and release. Has anybody got any updates on that?
No. Joe, did you have a chance to look at the release from December? Do you have any? Have you checked out any, is anything in there that you found interesting?
I haven't been able to go through all of those documents, no. What has been preoccupying my time is trying to come up with a total list of all risk numbers I could find, correlating with everything that I had from the review board and everything they put in the Federal Register, the unpublished list that they created that they summarized after April 8th, 1998, because they're releasing so much material and they're going out of business in 98. They did create lists. I do have them. You have to go to the National Archives to get them. And then with everything that was released in 2017 and 2018 and combining that into a list of RIF numbers, putting that in Excel, and then comparing that again when NARA took down their online database of RIFs, RIF sheets, really. You couldn't get to the actual document. They took that down in September a year or two ago. And then last year, they put up an Excel database of about five or six databases. And I've been going through all of that. So I finished that basically, and I have some RIF numbers that they don't have at all that they should. Some numbers jump around. Sometimes things jump around. And RIF numbers are divided into three. You have the three sections, I mean. The first section of three numbers is the intelligence agency. Then the first section of five numbers is the subject, and then the next, the third part of the second pairing of five numbers would be like how many documents on that subject an intelligence agency has. So I've been creating an Excel database on that, and I finished that. I've got like 330,000 plus RIF numbers. What I've been doing lately is going through CIA documents, because the Merrick Farrell Foundation, when they got stuff, the RIF numbers weren't quite up to snuff. They have documents before they got RIF numbers attached to them, and a lot of things are organized. You have to go back and forth and figure it out, which I did for some things.
Yeah, so Joe, the latest I got from Rex is that, so one of the attorneys went on the JFK, you know, on the collection website, and there was an Excel spreadsheet, and it claims there were 22,933 records that were being withheld in full or in part. Rex said that's in excess of the estimated 16,000 that's been, you know, said to be in play. He said this might be because there's 144 NSA records, 194 Army intelligence records, which do not appear in the official database, of 319,000 records. Not a single 155 Secret Service record. So that's interesting. That the potential number that was listed in the spreadsheet is more than they're publicly saying was still outstanding.
And I don't trust anyone's numbers but my own, because I don't think anyone but me has gone through everything. So I could share what I have, but it takes a while to explain what I have. And Bart has been sending me documents from Malcolm's collection. And Malcolm was a bit haphazard in what he collected, and it's also interspersed with stuff from other archives outside of NARA. But occasionally Malcolm will find a document, and sometimes he won't copy everything. Like, I would be anal and copy the RIF page, every part of a RIF page, if a RIF page was more than one page, and the entire document. Malcolm would only copy what interested Malcolm from a document. And sometimes Malcolm would copy the RIF page, and sometimes he wouldn't. So I'm spending a lot of time trying to figure out what the hell Bart just scanned and sent to me. But sometimes it's gold, and it's a RIF page, and it's a whole series of something that is not in any of the review board stuff or NARA stuff. Or it's a document that tells from an intelligence agency that we had not previously heard or known about has ever having records relating to the JFK case. So I'm going to go through that. And I've finished that, and I'm trying to go through CIA documents. The mid-range would start like 1001. I'm up to 1007. But that's really about 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 documents matching up the document with its 1993 number and with its proper RIF page. So it's slow, slow, slow going. But once I'm the CIA records in particular are tough to try to figure out that way, because a lot of the CIA records were released in 1993, and thus avoiding getting a RIF number for a long time. So I don't trust anyone's numbers when they say, oh, there's only so many thousand still upheld here and there. Oh, you know, no, sorry. So,
okay.
But I'd love to see whatever Excel or whatever database you just got.
Yeah, as I said, it's from the October 2017. So, you know, I'm probably going to get two more databases, one from 18 and then one, the most recent one, which is probably going to comprise, I would think, probably 2/3 of the outstanding documents that they've identified, just based on the, you know, the last.
Hey, David, could I share my screen for a while to show you what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. Go ahead.
Let me see if I could do that. Share screen. Is that working? I'll have to leave the meeting and come back a second. Hold on.
Okay, I'll let you right back in. Well, while we're waiting on Joe,
where's Brian?
Brian's in Colorado. He's on vacation.
Oh.
He's enjoying the mountains and his retirement.
He retired?
Yeah, he retired, I think it was 2 months ago.
Wow.
Yeah, he retired, so.
No more adventures on the roads, huh?
No, just when we go do our JFK stuff.
So. When is he relocating to Colorado?
Oh, no. He just went for a week, just him and his wife. They went for a sightseeing tour in up in Colorado. All right, Joe, we're back. We can see your screen now.
Now, is this your personal spreadsheet, Joe?
Joe, is your mic on mute?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. So let's do this. See if I can get this quickly done. Okay. So I'm going to. All right. This is what I got. Okay. So across the top here. Are all the come on, cooperate. What is that?
How many batches have been dumped?
The review board looked at about 46,
wow.
47 batches. Let me, if I can get this back again. That's not. What happened?
That looks like Haney Chat.
Yeah, that's not that's not what I want to show. I don't know why it's gone.
Are we going for a recount?
All right. Why is that? All right, never mind that. All right. So. I have 335,514 ref numbers, basically. And I'm scrolling.
315,000.
No, 355,000.
55,000.
335,513.
That's about 20,000 more than Rex said there were. Interesting.
Okay, so let me go. So I have a riff at the very top here. There's riff 104, 1001, 1000. Mm-hmm. That's a 1993 number. Mm-hmm. Okay, so and this is its title. And you click on that, and it'll give you the document in Mary Farrell. And then over here, we'll get you the RIF number. Because sometimes the RIF is not with the document. So the link will be
I've heard it sometimes, like with the Jim Johnson situation, there were two identical memos, and they had two different RIF numbers, but it was the same memo.
Could be. There are multiple copies of the same document throughout the selection. That happens a lot.
That will be reflected here?
Sometimes. It depends. That's not really what this is for, though. But this will be the RIF page, and that'll be the document. And in the middle here, I have the 1993 CIA RIF numbers.
Interesting.
So I've got this down. I'm into about, oops, come down. Only about 1,007. Okay. So, and there's the mid-range here, the middle number goes up to like 1,500 or so. Mm-hmm. So I got a lot to go. But when you go through everything, you find, sometimes numbers jump. 186 to 189. So 187 and 188 aren't listed for some reason.
Hmm.
And as you go down, if it's in black, I know it exists. If it's in green, I have a record of it in something that the review board did or the NARA released.
Mm-hmm.
If it's in red, it exists because that number jumped. As you scroll down, you'll see more and more red. See, red keeps coming.
Mm-hmm.
Happening.
So does that mean, so they obviously, they assigned a number, but it's what? It's not in the collection, or do we know it's in the collection, but it's withheld?
We don't know anything about it, because the numbers just jump.
But like when you have a red number.
Yeah.
See, those are numbers that you don't have. Okay, I see.
Okay, so this is the middle number that jumps.
Yes.
See? So for like 104, 10196, I know there are at least 357 documents.
Right.
But then you don't have anything until 104, 1209 in the middle number. So 197 to 10208. Those are middle numbers. That's CIA, and that's a subject that they're not telling me anything about, not just an individual document. So if these numbers should exist because 196 exists.
So wait,
9 exists.
Have you asked NARA in a FOIA request to identify these records?
No, not yet.
What? So why don't you at some point send me the list of red numbers.
Yeah.
And I'll send another FOIA request, and I'll add it to the lawsuit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly why I did this.
Okay, cool.
Because it's not only, you know, in the last part of the number, you're finding things jump, but in the first sequence, which is after the intelligence agency, 104 CIA.
Right.
First set of five numbers is supposed to be a subject, and those subjects went from 197 to 10208. We have nothing.
Wow.
And wait. So like 104, 10197 could have one document, or there could be 500 documents
right.
here. Nothing
right.
about.
That's what I was going to ask you. We don't know how many.
And that's true for the next one,
yeah.
and the next one, and the next one, and the next one.
Wow.
There could be thousands of documents between here
yep.
and here.
Yep, yep, yep. But the fact that numbers were created means the document exists somewhere, right?
You would think.
I mean, at least it existed at one time.
Well, I mean, how did they get to the next number, you know?
Yeah.
If you have the number 1 as a document and the next number you have is 17, where are 2 through 16?
This is fascinating. We definitely need to follow up with
that's just So about the first 90,000 are CIA. Then you go to 124, that's FBI.
Yeah.
Ooh. See all the red?
Whoa. Okay, go back to that. Yeah.
There's a lot. It's not just FBI and CIA.
Yeah, I think the FBI is the key here because Hoover was controlling the entire investigation.
176?
What's 176?
I don't know offhand.
That's not the church committee, is it?
No, that's 157.
Okay, right.
I know it, but I have to look it up off. I don't know offhand. 179. There's a lot missing.
That's ATSA, right? No, that's 180s. Is 176.
Well, what Joe has done here is, instead of just talking about, oh, we're missing documents, he's got to actually list it out here by numbers and by color coding to show you a physical idea of just how many damn documents are gone, yeah, you know, that we don't have.
This is fascinating.
This took about 2 years to do.
You should write an article about this or you know, or we got to get this to the archives. And
yeah.
Ask them for to identify these documents. At the very least, I mean, even if they're withheld, you know, what are these documents?
Mark, you've got your
CIA, CIA, FBI, and 180 is HSCA.
Yeah.
But let me just get past 180. There's some other ones in the 190s are Army intelligence.
Mark, you've got your hand up. Did you want to add something to this? You're on mute. Unmute.
Yeah, I sent a email a couple of months ago, I think, to Joe. I'm a retired DBA from a school district, and I would typically work with millions of records in a relational database. This is great. These files are great, but it's a flat file. It really needs to be in a relational database where we can bring in all kinds of other data and correlate it. And I'd be happy to work with Joe if he is interested in my help. But with a flat file database, you've got multiple lines of records, and then you have just multiple columns of items. And those really should be in a relational database, and we can have millions of records as opposed to working in an Excel spreadsheet. So I'd like to work with Joseph if he's interested.
Joe, I figured out 176, believe it or not, is the JFK library.
Ah.
And there's a whole bunch of records that Robert Kennedy's trust has not released. And there
yeah,
is,
well, those wouldn't even be in the ones I'm looking at.
Well, they are in the JFK library. So they may,
yeah.
They may be considered JFK library records. I
right.
Don't know if there are, so what's the other numbers that I'm missing? Cause I just found the prefixes.
From 194, 195, 196, 197.
194
documents around that are in come on.
So 194 is U.S. Army Investigative Records. 195
right.
is the Office of the Secretary of Defense. 196 is the Customs Service. What else did you have?
Like 195, 196, 198 or so. There are like U.S.
Yeah, they're all Army. Those are all
they're
Army.
They're all Army, yeah.
Yeah.
Army Intel is people should think of this is CIA, FBI, HSCA, and Army Intel.
Yep.
And those are, I mean, everyone talks FBI, CIA, and HSCA. Army intel, there's about as much Army intel as there are CIA or FBI. And no one's talking about them.
Fascinating. I mean, I really feel that, you know, it's time for the Kennedy family to step up. I understand this has been a painful thing for them, but they're holding back. First of all, I'm actually exploring the concept that they never had the authority to put restrictions on the autopsy materials, because the autopsy materials traditionally are owned by the medical facility. You have rights to see your documents, but the autopsy materials are owned by the office, you know, that performed the autopsy, the medical records office. And then I believe that Berkeley did not have the authority to give these records to the Kennedy family, and therefore, when the Kennedy family gave them back to the federal government with conditions, I don't think they had the right to enforce those conditions.
Maybe that's the HIPAA rules.
Number two, the Kennedy family has, we have lots of Bobby Kennedy records that have not been released. They were, you know,
right.
And they pertain presumably to Cuba. And the idea that they can withhold, that they imposed conditions on William Manchester's interviews, again, you know, there's no reason at this point in time for whatever Jackie or Bobby said to William Manchester to be withheld. So there's a couple of lawsuits that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, you'll run into donor deed of gifts there, I would think, but.
Yeah, but the idea, at least on the, so what I'm saying is I believe, I have an argument that I'm working on to articulate that the donor, that the gift of deed was invalid, that they never had the authority to gift that material because they didn't have the legal rights to them.
Right, probably.
So I got a bunch of things that I'm, you know, we have weekly meetings with our lawyers, and I've been throwing these ideas out to test them, because I really feel that the Kennedy family has, you know, they have an obligation to history as well. And as I mentioned to Will in the chat room, I actually had a blind date with the woman, the typical of my life. Turned out that she was a staff attorney for the Judiciary Committee when Ted Kennedy was chair, and her boss was Walter Sheridan.
Oh, well.
And she had some conversations with him about Ruby, and she said, how could he be not mobbed up, blah, 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 and Walter Sheridan just looked at her and said, you're a smart woman, you can figure that out. But she said to me that based on her conversation, she had the impression that the Kennedy family knew what happened, that they had done enough of their own investigation, that they knew what happened, which makes, again, all this is beginning to come to me that there is an embarrassment behind the Kennedy's family's refusal to be open, and the embarrassment has to go back to the mafia, and that the old man had two contracts on him that Giacconi terminated. And I think there's some messy stuff there that they would prefer to not get out because it would tarnish the reputation of the family. Anyway, these are all the batches?
This is what I was trying to show before. So, like, here's the first batch in 1995, the review board released. That was, like, 16 documents at first. So, then you go, and I had all the RIF numbers on this first column A, and then I put in the first. So this would take you to the ARB's listing in the Federal Reserve, in the Federal Register.
So do you have?
So that would go to, hold on, April 8th, 1998. So those, all those Federal Register.
Right.
Now I have scans of these from April 27th, 98 to October 98. You have to go to the National Archives in the review board's files to find these.
Oh, wow.
But I have them, and I have them scanned.
And then, can you go back to the first column?
April 27th or the very first?
Well, the first. What's the first column you have of records?
This, June 26, 1995 in the Federal Register.
So what happened? So what about the ones that the 93, you know, the ones that were released before ARB?
Well, that's tough to figure out because there was no real list of what was released.
Uh-huh.
It was because it was before the review board came into existence, so there was no RIF system per se. And the CIA released some stuff. The first release was really in August of 93. And you didn't have the review board yet. You didn't have what later became the RIF system.
So unless you're able to match the 93 numbers with the RIF,
you're out of luck.
Right. And then anything that was released, like pursuant to a FOIA request that may be like with Harold, you know, Weisberg's collection, you know, it might not, we don't know, for example, if some of those might be the red numbers. I mean, things that are.
No. And then you have the 2017 releases and the 18 and the 2021. And they're all cross-referenced against each other.
Okay.
So that, yes, would correspond to, look at that thing. RIF number. And then I would note that it was released several times.
Mm.
That 13 was released a few times.
Now, how many, when you have the MSF column, how many records do you have a total at the bottom indicating how many of these are in the MSF collection?
I tried to hear.
Yeah.
What MSF, are they there or not? But you'd have to go look at that.
Wow.
Get this RIF number. Go to the Mary Farrell page, put yes or no here.
So have you done that or you haven't done that yet?
I've done that. To some extent here, see?
Okay. Yeah.
So, yes and no.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So it takes forever.
Yeah. It's very time-consuming and meticulous. So, like, if Harold Weisberg got documents released in 77 or whenever, 80 or something, unless they have been subsequently put into the collection, would they be reflected here?
No. Well, not in my Excel database, but what you would do, you would try to get a copy of that document, and then get a copy of that document from NARA, but you wouldn't know what its RIF number in NARA is.
Mm.
You would have to have the original document and have a good enough memory or to know that, oh, that's RIF number this or that, or like do an advanced search on Mary Farrell using dates or proper nouns or whatever you would have in the original document to try to find.
Like what David does search engine, I guess.
Right. Instead of a RIF search, do an advanced search, and you could maybe find it that way.
Oh.
If Mary Farrell has it to begin with. You know, Mary Farrell would not necessarily have everything that Harold Weisberg had.
Right. Now, have you shared this with Rex so that he could try to populate it, or no?
I think I did at one point.
Okay. And then, like, stuff that Bart is disclosing, if Malcolm didn't have a RIF number on it, again, same issue, you'd have to do some sort of advanced search to see whether that document is reflected elsewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
What I usually do, my two cents, is I look for specific phrases in the document, and in Mary Farrell, you can just put that in quotations, and it'll find any document that has that phrase in there.
Huh.
That's the way I look for documents there.
Well,
you can also use the and, you know, for example, I'm sorry, David. I'm just going to finish. For example, a date and a name, and then you put in quotations, and then "and" in uppercase, quotations, whatever, and it'll, you can do as many combinations as you want. And that's another effective way.
Yeah, I have an Excel database I created for what Malcolm is, as well, what Bart has scanned of Malcolm stuff. So.
And so you've created that, but you haven't yet cross-referenced it? I've done the, you've done the search. Oh, look at this.
So this is Mal, this is looking at Bart's email stuff.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
So it's just, if I can find it, it's in the blue.
So,
I mean, it's trying to figure out what the hell. Malcolm has a lot of good stuff. And if you're lucky, it's something that's not in anything that the review board or NARA has.
Really?
And then you can, then you know that, okay, from what NARA had, the doc for an intelligence agency and like say 1004 CIA and 1009, and then I know they have 211 documents on that subject, and then Malcolm would find document 422. So now you know, okay, now I have to up it from 211 to 422 and put all those numbers in. And then all of that would be in red because you know it must exist because Malcolm got up to a higher number.
So like on document number 185, that was just the one. So you have a church committee file in RIF order, but there's no RIF number. What does that mean?
That might mean that Malcolm didn't copy the RIF.
Oh. And then it says it's not in the online.
15 pages of RIF numbers from 1572 to that. I have to go back and look at that again. But Malcolm was a bit messy in what he copied. He didn't get the whole document.
A lot of researchers are that way.
I want to show you an example here, what I'm talking about. Okay, here's this Warren the Brew Oswald F. Fair Play for Cuba Committee report of 1025. And it's just like you guys have been saying, it's under so many RIFs. You know, I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and as I say, probably others as well. But this is one that I believe is extremely important because if you look at the third, cover page, it's supposed to be a 40-page document, okay? And Bill Simpichin and I have been looking for the rest of this document. We can't find it. And a lot of these RIFs have the first two pages, but then they go off into other documents that have nothing to do with the cover page or what is being outlined, you know, in the first two pages, all right? And that's something, and this one I believe is very important because
I can explain that a little bit. What? If a document like that Larry's showing was 40 pages.
Right.
And 20 pages were released before the review board came into existence, they would not release those 20 pages again. They would release the 20 that had been withheld. So you would have to go into another part of the collection to find those 20 pages that were previously released, put them together with the 20 that they just released, and then you would have the 40 pages.
So
it's a huge, huge pain in the ass, but it could be done. And that may or may not be why you're not finding all those 40 pages, but sometimes that happens.
Well, the FBI reports had a specific order and syntax, okay? And the way each, if you go and you look at other reports that have not been eviscerated, you can see a pattern, not on this one. And we've been through this a while. You know, those 38 pages are definitely missing.
So, Joe and Larry, there is an emerging narrative coming out that the records are really not. In fact, this guy Robertson, I think, wrote on Max Holland's website. Let me just, what was that article?
I can't find them right now. Basically, that there's really no there. And it's time for the media to reflect that this is just, you know, there really isn't anything there. I think we need to write an article or have a journalist, and I could get some journalists. Now, I know that the guy that wrote the story about me was from Epoch or Epoch Times, which a lot of you people are going to get indigestion just hearing the name of that paper because it's out there on the right fringe. But, you know, my view is any place, if it's Lou Rockwell, if it's American Thinker, any place that's willing to publish. And honestly, at this point, I don't think publishing on Kennedy and King helps us because we're talking to the parish there, right? So, I think we need to write an article about that. There's a story behind these records, how complicated the holes there are. It's not intuitive, Joe. As you go through this, this is something that has to be explained. I think we need to put together an article and, you know, basically about the flaws in the system and, you know, what do we need to do to really get the complete story before we can actually put this to rest in terms of the records review. And this is something that I would want, if we get an oversight hearing, I want Joe, you to come and testify to talk about it. You got to start thinking about how to organize your thoughts. But I think we need to do an article, or at least I can get reporters to cover this. So, and you don't have to, like, right now, the job isn't to try to get all the reds identified. It's the fact that we have all these reds.
Right.
Right. And before that batch, you know, do we know that we've gotten everything that's been released? You mentioned 6 months ago that I didn't realize that a lot of these FOIA requests, unless those people put their collection into the archives, they could be records out there like Malcolm or Gary or, you know, whoever has records that they may not be in the JFK records collection because of the way those documents were disclosed.
Yeah, and like you mentioned before, Weisberg spent decades fighting against the government, you know, and Jim Lazar and him, you know, they took this, I mean, they pushed this as far as they could, you know, without the ARRB.
I think his collection was put into the records collection, right?
No.
No.
I found a couple of documents that are not in the JFK collection that came specifically from Weisberg.
Harold Weisberg's collection is unique to Harold Weisberg, and Gerald McKnight got all that stuff donated to
Hood College.
Hood College, which is near where Harold was living, and I think they have everything and they've scanned
amazing, and that's an amazing feat because Harold and Gerald, you know, at the end were like, you know, at each other's throats, you know?
That's really great. But you're saying that there are records in the Weisberg collection that are not in the official JFK collection?
Sure.
Oh, I would say definitely. But, I mean, you would have to do a page-by-page, document-by-document comparison. I mean, there's no way to know.
Okay.
I want to, Dave Knight, you're here, right? David?
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you tell us how you were able to get your copy of the entire collection? Because you sent me a copy of that, and maybe you can chime in on that.
Are you talking about the Weisberg collection?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, let me pull up a screen share here real quick.
What was the name of that fellow that got you the entire collection?
Right.
You were able to, right.
Clay, right? His name is
Clay. So it's not exclusively on a website. We have it on disk. Okay?
Yeah, he gave me, right, Clay gave me a disk, not a disk, I basically bought...
it's a terabyte, yeah. It's
right, and then so he hasn't scanned everything yet, but yes, that's, I have the thing as well.
Well, if you want to see the, what's known as the folder index.
Yeah. Right.
Now, the folder index is where everything that we got that was on the hard drive from
Clay.
Ogilvie.
When I met up with him in Dallas, me and Brian went to Dallas to the library and did some scanning. Well, then we came back, and I met with him out in Lawrence, which is where Brian's at, and he had the entire collection, you know, scanned onto a hard drive, and then I made a copy of it, and we have it in our archives now. But I most everything that I saw that was in the archive, or it was which was in the disk drive that he gave me, it's right here online.
Right.
Now, obviously, it's a whole hell of a lot easier to just clone the drive than to sit here and download every single thing. But anything that you want, I mean, you can go to the main page of Weisberg, which is right here.
Run a search, yeah.
You know, run a search. But if you want to go directly into an index, which is where all the index files are at.
Which it wasn't supposed to be. We discovered that from working with that. You can't get to that anymore.
Well, actually, you can, because if you go to productjfk.com.
I know. But before, if you put up a file, a document, you could backtrack on the directory tree and get to there. You can't do that anymore. The other thing, when you sent me that entire collection on the disk, he's got the Sylvia Marr files in there. And I found those to be very, very...
What files?
Sylvia Marr.
Oh, Sylvia Marr. Okay.
Let me see if those are on here.
No, you'd have to back up. It's a special... You'd have to back up on the directory tree.
Under M, right, for Marr?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it would be, under M. But that's her correspondence. I'm talking about... her specific document collection.
I know what you're talking about now. Yeah.
Right. And I found it on that disc that you made for me.
Yeah, he got her materials, right? And he put it into his collection.
Yeah, they put them at the hood. At the hood.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, they know how to get to the main page. But as far as the index file,
click on parent directory at the top there. Click on parent directory there. It'll back you up right there. See, and if you go down, you'll see Sylvia Marr there.
Right there.
But then if you click there, they're not there. If you click there, the link is broken. The one that you sent me had all of that.
Yeah.
And the Ray Marcus, everything.
Well, what I did with that is, I got that from Clayton Ogilvie. Clayton, that's his name, Clayton Ogilvie.
Mm-hmm.
And, he made it available to us, so we do have it in the archives now. The Project JFK archives, which is where we've got, several backup hard drives. And I think that one there was it would all fit on a, one terabyte, but... I think I've got a 512, and I've got everything backed up on a 512 gig, 512 gigabyte hard drive. It's a massive collection. It took, I think, to make the copies when you're moving that many files over. I mean, hell, it took 17 hours. I mean, it was a long process of cloning those drives.
Yeah, I had basically, when I was talking to him, I had to buy a drive to his specifications. I mailed it to him. He loaded everything on it and then mailed it back to me.
Yep.
See, but the thing about that is having your drive is how are you going to search through it, because he's got so many files, any search functions, the best way, the way it is right now where Google searches it for you, and then gives you the listing or whatever you punch in there.
I use it when I search it, I'm searching for a specific thing. So, if it's
phrase or a name. Yeah, but so many PDFs, it's just.
Right.
Okay, I want to share something here real quick. Let me download this photograph and then I can pull it up. Our friend Doug Campbell, the one I was talking about earlier with his links on the affiliated website page, he has sent me a photograph that he wants me to share. So, let me get this pulled up real quick.
While you're doing that, Mark, what we're talking about, how would the relational, how does that change the way you look at these documents?
the way that you look at them, you can query the database using English language queries. But the good thing is you create a separate table for each item. Let's say the files that are on Malcolm's database, instead of trying to intersperse them to one Excel spreadsheet, you would just have a separate table for his data, and then you would relate the data from the master records to his, and then all of the missing records or the incomplete records would pop out immediately, and you don't have to do these tremendous searches and things on an Excel database. You can type in, you know, you could just say something as simple, show me the records that don't match from the British, from Malcolm's data to Joe's data. And it's as simple as that.
Hey, Larry, this is Bob. I heartily support Mark's ideas here. He clearly has professional experience in this area. And at some point I'll share it to you, but I developed a relational database for this very thing with this very kind of data way before the Records Act back in the 70s. It's very powerful, but and this is no way a negative comment about Mark's suggestion, but it does take a degree of expertise, planning, and design to do it well with the complexity of what Joe has been showing us and what you've been accumulating. So it can be done, but it's not the kind of thing where somebody says, I'll go off and play with it and I'll be back in a week. It takes a great deal of effort. And then the thing that derailed our project was populating the database. We had the relational database design and it worked the way Mark described it. But we had, this is back in the 70s, hundreds of thousands of records even then. And we just did not have the wherewithal financially to pay people to, in those days, actually key it in on using key punch machines. So it's just, it's something that's powerful, useful, valuable, but it would take resources to accomplish. I'm just curious, Mark, based on your experience, do you concur or do you reject
that? Yeah, Bob, you're absolutely right. It's like building a house. The database is only as good as the foundation. And the foundation is what might take, you know, 6 or 7 months. Populating the data really should be an easy process because it looks like Joe has a lot of the information already or Malcolm has it or it's somewhere else. So to populate, once you create the tables, populating them is fairly simple. But the issue is, Bob, you're absolutely right. Building this grand design for this database, and it would certainly take a group of us to come up with some kind of idea. Number one, of what we want to see, and then number two, actually building the the database to meet our needs. The good thing is about SQL, it's very flexible. So if we miss something, you just create another table and populate it. And but I think we're talking about so much information now and so complex. If you saw Joe's table, he's into the 30 or 40 or 50 columns of information, and a SQL database just doesn't have that, or you just don't need it. That would be a separate database within a separate table within the SQL database, and you would just populate it. You don't have to do all that cross-referencing with an Excel spreadsheet. And plus, the speed at which SQL works, you could analyze millions of records in, you know, a tenth of a second or two-tenths of a second. And there are multiple online databases that are free and available. So it wouldn't cost us anything to build the database. Because the software is free, what would take the time, and Bob is absolutely right, is building this foundational database. But I see it, the more I see all this data, the more I realize that the only way to do it is with the relational database. And I'd be happy to show people what I'm talking about. Maybe do a demo the next meeting or something.
And Mark,
Let me just follow up. Or anyone, does anyone know that what NARA is contemplating in its digital project, does that include relational database?
That's a question that popped into my mind, Larry, is that when I look at the way they render it on the website, it's by nature, since it's a display only, it's hard to know what's under the covers. So that could be actually populated by a relational database, or it could just simply be flat data. I suspect the latter, because that's the kind of thing that people in the organization could probably do without investing thousands of hours. But and to Mark's point, I mean, if you want to, you know, again, I'm only saying this in context of what is being discussed here. I've already actually done all this. I developed a relational database for the Committee to Investigate Assassinations. And although it used SQL, the structured query language, as its fundamental mechanism, it is dated, obviously, from the 70s, but the principles are the same. And I have a presentation on that if there's something of interest. And again, I don't want to divert. David and I have been talking privately of whether the group might be interested in hearing about it, but maybe at minimal, a subgroup of people interested in this element of it, Joe and Larry Rivera and you and others, maybe we want to get together with a smaller group to discuss it, not with the intention of excluding anybody, but just trying to not bore anybody. So that's what I can offer. I do have a whole example of having actually done this.
But because of the date of your project obviously would not have RIF numbers.
No. The way that it worked is it accumulated references to data, not the data itself. And I can't explain it now without you visualizing it, and I don't want to divert this meeting to that. Like I say, maybe a future meeting we can talk about it. But what you would do is I developed an English-like query language that would allow you to actually enter a question. And even in my example from 50 years ago, I remember that I had a question sample, you know, where was Lee Harvey Oswald at this date and this time?
Oh, wow.
And what it would return to you would not be the answer. It would be a reference to Warren Hearings, Volume 7, page 421, line 30, Sylvia Meyer, Thomas Buchanan, and so forth. And it would give you all the references to answer the question. And then the second impact that it would have is that it would do correlations. And the correlations, by that I mean, is that if somebody asked where Larry Schnapp was on a certain day and time and got back some data that said here at this time, and a completely separate query said where was Bob on this day and time, and the return data actually indicated that we were in the same place, it establishes a relationship between Larry and Bob that may not have been known before simply by proximity. So it was relational in the data IT geek sense, and it was also relational in the generation of leads.
Huh.
And then the third effect was we had researchers back in the 70s on the West Coast and the East Coast and the UK, all over the world, spinning their wheels, doing research on the very same topics, coming up with the very same information. And these correlations would give attributions that would allow an individual to say, hey, I'm already researching that. Don't waste your time. And so it added an efficiency effect. So these are the potential outcomes of doing something like this. It's very powerful, and notwithstanding it being free, as Mark points out, because SQL, there are a number of implementations of SQL that are available for free. It does require some planning and thinking. And I think, Mark, you threw in a number like of months or whatever, 8 months. I would say absolutely minimum. It would probably take that or a year just to sort of design it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And we could be driven by the phenomenal work that Joe has done
Absolutely.
That others have done.
Absolutely. That would be the template, I think, for starting of the tables. And then, Bob, whatever you had, we could add on to it or extract information from it. SQL stands for Structured Query Language. So if you want to search something, you just say, select this from this where, you know, Larry was located on 10/12/1965. You could just say that just like in an English statement and you would get your data.
Wow.
So Larry, if you want to underwrite this.
How much do you think it would cost?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the cost, the obvious cost up front is not dollars. It's human time.
Mm-hmm. We've underwritten, we've got investors for John Orr's, you know, project, the 3D animation. And John Orr and I are the general partners, but we waived any profits to get more people, and we're just going to get our money back. But
right. So here's an aspect of this that may distinguish it with that. And I know you had approached me a couple of years ago on that project and so forth. The thought in the back of my head is that if this group as a core and the people, you know, there are 15 people still remaining who are listening to this conversation, this evolves as a value statement for the group and for the objective of the human beings around the world that are doing what we're doing here. It has to have one key element that what I did back in the 70s, we knew going in was a risk and we failed because of it. It has to have, call it what you want, but sustainability and longevity. So just for the sake of the argument, let's say, you know, Mark and I and a couple of other people jump in and we actually have something that is better than a prototype. It has to have a plan in which it can survive the next decade and for the next generation of researchers. It has to have a home that's sustainable. It has to have choices that are made technologically that will map to the future. In other words, you can't use archaic software, and it has to have the people to drive it. And that's a hard thing because the people we know are the people we're looking at on this meeting right now. There's a reasonably wide range of ages, tending more to be more senior folks. So I'm going to say I don't want to sound like I'm pontificating after I sound like I've been pontificating, but I've seen so many things go.
I'm thinking that there's an opportunity, depending on how this design, if this could be used not only just for JFK, but for other historical investigations, or just government data in general, there might be some foundations that might be willing to invest in this because it might advance their missions.
That's why I made the comment about, you know, what NARA has got going.
Yeah.
I mean, they have countless millions of items of all types for centuries, and they have to be managing them in some reasonable way. Although I will add that in 1973, that my project was, I proposed it to the United States Senate, and in that time, the United States Senate didn't have a single computer, let alone a database.
So we know that there was a recent article about, there was testimony. I think it may have been part of the week, you know, in March, with the FOIA thing, Sunshine Week, that effectively NARA's budget has been flat for 30 years. And maybe there's an opportunity to go to them and say, we have this software that could make your job easier without increasing your staffing. You know, and given the great growth, geometric or maybe exponential growth of document records, I'm just trying to think out loud that maybe something that, you know, you can license it, you know?
I don't mean to sound that kind of classic, but I worked for a very large multinational conglomerate for 45 years, and there's a phenomena that you, I don't know if you've heard in the legal profession, but technological people have heard it. The acronym is NIH, and that stands for Not Invented Here.
Yes.
So if you're familiar with it, the notion of not invented here in the private sector is very powerful. I can't imagine it not being in play in government. So I don't disagree with the concept that you're thinking out loud about, Larry, but I'm not sure you would go with them with an end product. You might go with them with a concept, an idea, even a prototype, but unless they do it.
Well, anytime someone goes to them, when the government is buying computer software, is it already done, or is it like sort of saying, here's something we can design for you?
It's all over the map.
Yeah. So I think we have an opportunity here. I'm just, you know, obviously, this is just, we're just, you know, spitballing. But at the end of the day, like what they did with the scanning of their cartridges, you know, there might be some pilot programs. I know that for forensics, the government's giving grants for people to do research in advancing forensic science, quote unquote science. So there might be some informational stuff. There's got to be something out there that if we get some people to focus on that, to see if there's any opportunities to use the Kennedy assassination as the model for this idea.
Yep. And I want to say, and you know, many years ago, Joe Backus and I had collaborated. I wouldn't say collaborated, but we did some things that were together because we have physical proximity in New York. And I just occurred to me as I watched what Joe was demonstrating, and I heard Mark's comments. This is completely an unpaid for recognition, but I want to admire Joe for having done what he's done, because having to do that in what Mark referred to as a flat file or a flat world, which is what a spreadsheet is. A spreadsheet is really not a database. I understand the use of the word, and I don't want to be anal about that use, but it's just a bunch of records that are organized into cells. But what he has accomplished in what I can see is extraordinary. And so, Joe, kudos to you for having done all of that. And I do see that you're still here. You popped to the top of the list. And the mapping between his efforts and all of the elements that have fed into that summary, if you will, from all the people you've referred to, people whose names you have much greater knowledge of than I do, is a powerful stepping off point for the potential design of a relational database. And even with that, it would still, in my opinion, have fits and starts. But the good news about the structured query language is that you can start building it, and then if it doesn't go well, you can restructure it without losing the bulk of what you've done up to that point. So I'm trying to tread the ground between not being discouraging but also being realistic, and remember that this project has to be put in the context of all the other potential things that consume time and money, and what the benefit or the ultimate outcome will be. So if this is a cool project, but even if it was successful, the result would not be of as significant or a greater benefit than another two or three projects, then we have to prioritize.
I think it would make sense to have Bob and Mark and Joe and Larry, you know, noodle together some thoughts until our next call, and, you know, guys talk and talk it out and see if something comes to form. And then we can, I mean, you know, my skill set is not this, but I know how to organize things and get things moving. But if you guys could come up with some ideas of how this might look, and, you know, then I think now the other thing is I do think an article would also elicit interest. So, you know, it's going to be like a 21st century look at the records, you know, how to look at the records. You know, I've been using the Innocence Project, what we've learned from the Innocence Project about the limitations on forensic evidence, and using it to take a look back at the Kennedy assassination and say the Kennedy assassination, you know, with the original junk science case. So there might be something, again, you know, how can we use modern software, first identify the problems and then come up with the ways to fix it.
I'll chat with David a little bit more offline. It just coincidentally, he and I, within the last week or so, have had an exchange, and one of the things that he threw out there, I actually threw it out initially, he said maybe there would be value in me talking about this project. It was in the historical context. In other words, what were we doing back in the Committee to Investigate Assassination days and so forth? And that may be a dual benefit of looking at the historical experience and then as a stepping off point to what you're proposing. And then I'll talk with David about that. Maybe we could do it for the next meeting.
And then when you get some fleshing out of the idea, then we can start trying to figure out how much would this really cost.
Yep.
And then we could either, at that point, you know, either try to do a GoFundMe, lots of people, you know, donating small amounts of money, or going out there and trying to address, you know, the idea that this could be licensable for other applications, that if we use it for the Kennedy assassination, that would be like a whole high-profile example of how to use this, and that might attract investors who will look at licenses.
And I wouldn't dismiss another notion, which is that it is very possible that this, and I use this in quotations, has already been done. But maybe the actual core data represents some different venture. But the concept and the structures of putting together historical data intensely associated with records and now an actual, you know, reference information form number system and so forth, maybe the variants. And so that's sort of what we would call quasi-turnkey.
And that would be something, again, to do, someone do some research, Google it or something, see if anyone out there is touting any capabilities like this.
And I mean, then,
I believe that there's some of the historical, you know, I mean, even corporations have lots of records. So there's got to be someone. Think about all these relational databases out there. You know, did Oracle or whatever, you know, one of them come up with something like this?
Yeah, well, Oracle is a commercialized version of a relational database, and there are a number of others. But as Mark has already alluded to, SQL went down parallel paths in what they call the open software model.
MySQL.
Like,
Larry is right. MySQL is the one that is, in fact, virtually every website that you see that is online now, MySQL is what drives that website. I would suspect that even Project JFK and the blogs that have been, you know, that David populates and so forth, MySQL is the underlying data repository. And there's a language on top of that and so forth. So now we're really getting, you know, nerdy.
And then maybe that some company, like I was once, a company approached me and how do you do due diligence, environmental due diligence on a transaction? And I kind of did a flow and they bought that intellectual property from me. If I was smart enough, I would license it if I was younger then. But maybe we come up with something for this particular application that may be an Oracle type of the world.
I think one of the main issues here is creating, and I think Bob mentioned it, a front end that you can use to manage, because it's not just, you know, the data itself. And MySQL, I've worked with Linux, MySQL, you know, in order for example, in order to work with it on your computer, you have to install not just MySQL, you have to install other programs that are required, like PHP, Apache, you know, in order to run the MySQL on that platform. So it's not just a matter of, you know, there are many different forks here that have to be dealt with.
You build it like a pyramid, and I 100% agree with Larry. I actually spent more time developing the natural language query system back in the 70s than I did on the actual database.
Wow.
And so that may not be true now because we live in an AI world. You don't even have to type anymore. You can just look at stuff or verbalize it and you can get queries. But the point is that it's a multifaceted endeavor that these kinds of common conversations are what industry does and what government does. An idea plants a seed. You look for other plants that are growing that have similar species so that you don't reinvent things. And you all know it. You come from your world of either, you know, amateur or professional or just consumer exposure to these things on a daily basis. And it's possible to be done. The question is it realistic? And there are like a dozen measures of realistic.
And Bob, another thing that just came to mind is maybe there's some college kids that want to work on this, right? And they're much more conversant on, say, the AI side. I don't know anything about this stuff. I don't know if you have stayed on top of things and, you know, so, but there may be, I had once some college kids that wanted to help. I was trying to figure out a way of predicting how certain kinds of litigation would go in certain ways. And we were going to work on a program. And then, of course, the big guys decided to enter the field. So I was preempted. But we might also be able to find some college kids that are experts in computer engineering or something. And I'm just spitballing ideas, you know, and that'd be a great way to have young people engaged in this.
Yep.
Hey, Larry, this is Brooks. Just want to make a comment because I'm hearing kind of the classical art versus science components of this. And my take, just listening to you guys, is that the software itself is a science. And the art, from what Mark said and what Bob's added to, is this work that's got to be done over a period of 8, 9, 12 months to basically build that platform, the basis upon which that software can execute. And you're aided by the fact if you have insider knowledge. So people who are, and correct me if I'm missing the point on this, but it sounds like it would be very beneficial to have people like Bob and Larry and others who have, and Joe are knee deep in this, because that's the art part of this, is creating that platform on which the software is going to execute. So I don't know how much of it we can delegate to, say, software students or whatnot. And I'm just spitballing ideas here, but there's always an art component to everything. You know what I mean? It isn't just pure science, but
I think you're right. But I think that there are unique issues with this collection that we would need the expertise of Bob and Larry and Mark, but then there might be, you might have the kids can then sort of put, you know, you work with them and they know maybe some more bones than we know.
So these are the very kinds of conversations that when talked out in civil matter lead to good decision making. And so here's one, Brooks, the notion of art versus science is extremely powerful because you could argue that regardless of what database you're using, a relational database, the emphasis is on the word relational. And that's the art. How do you establish the relationships? Once you have someone who knows how the database works, that's just an implementation issue that's based on the science. And ideally, this is literally an off-the-shelf item that you use. But now is the art of trying to put together relationships that serve the ultimate need. In the chat, those of you who are monitoring it, Peter has offered some interesting insights into, for example, this prolific free version of SQL that's called MySQL, and I'm assuming, although it's not stated in his comments, a commercial version. And without debating that here, that's an example of the kind of decision making that is very important. You can go down the open software and free route, but what are the risks associated with it? You can go down, and again, not a judgment, Larry, on your comment. You can go down the route of college students, but they're gone in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. And so at what point do you have to buy into longevity, reliability, maintainability, sustainability. And you all face this every day. You know, am I going to buy a subscription to Zoom, or am I going to use the free version, or am I going to get SQL? And this is not intended to be self-serving, but I could kick myself now, years later. I did share this with a couple of people, but I happen to hold a patent, and my patent is actually for web-based dependency on MySQL, because I'm the guy who invented the blog, what's called the weblog.
Really?
But I work for a large company, and when I signed on with them, they own every patent.
I got it.
Unbelievably, they never exercised that patent. And it has since expired. And of course, could you imagine
the
millions they could have made? There are, I only tell that story not for self-aggrandizement, because I only have that one patent, which was basically, you know what a blog is. It's basically a self-authoring web page. You know, you can write onto a web page and all of a sudden it's published on a web page. And that's very powerful. But what I'm saying is that those tools are so advanced now compared to where they were before that ideally we find the pieces that fit into the objective. You don't let the tool drive the objective. You let the objective drive the tool, in my humble opinion.
But, Bob, is the question about open versus closed a function of this may cost us X amount of dollars. If we do it open, we're not going to be able to attract investors to pay for this. Is that sort of like part of the conversation?
I don't know for sure, but I would suspect that anybody who is investing money is doing it for potential profitability, right? So, I mean, that's the underlying reason.
Yeah,
so they want to know, you know, not what is going to return to me next week. They want to know what it's going to return to me in 5 years.
Right.
So do I go out and get a copy of MySQL and do this, and it's really cool, and we don't have to ask David for money or to put up a sustain page online or, you know, one of the various tools that you can use to, you know, GoFundMe. Or do you go to a company at the other end of the spectrum like Oracle that's making hundreds of millions of dollars a year providing this very relational database solution to companies and governments and whatever all over the world?
Or if you find a Bill Gates foundation or some other foundation that to them this advances their mission and therefore you don't have to worry about profits. Right?
And that is the wonderfulness and highly volatile nature of altruism.
Yeah.
If every person in the world could find somebody who was an altruistic benefactor, think of the things we could accomplish. But those are rare, I think.
Yeah. Well, why don't you guys noodle on this project? We could give it a name. It's part of the JFK, Project JFK. It's going to be a subgroup or a subcommittee or whatever. And then once you guys come up with what your idea is, then we can think about how do we make this happen? Are there foundations out there that might support us? Do we have to go? Is it going to be a lot of money that, you know, or is it going to not be a lot of money?
Right. And of course, I'm speaking out of turn in the context of Project JFK, because I have to admit that although I've been, you know, a lurker for several years now, I would have to talk and basically understand how, you know, from David and Brian and so forth, what is the, if you will, the board of directors objectives and does this fit in? So I'm in no way speaking for this organization. I'm just using the platform because the subject came up.
Boy, this is, I'm not going to speak to you, David, but this is very consistent with what we've been doing about putting stuff on the website and records and digital. I mean, this is the next step. You know, you put stuff on the website, but then what do you do with it?
Right. So you've seen two examples of it, and I'll stop right after that. You've seen what Joe has done with Excel. And then I don't know what's under the covers, but you saw David show a disk structure that was, I suspect, conveniently organized by using an alphabetic approach.
Yeah.
So it was intrinsically defined as no greater than 26 high-level categories. And that's what we do. That's what we're human beings. And so we structure things based on how we're our brains are programmed, and you know, it's why we recognize spaces, why we recognize the alphabet. But is that a way, if you, Larry, went to David and said, in that big, huge structure of files and folders that he had, and asked him to find something, is it even conceivable that he could, if it was obscure? And yeah, I mean, I don't know the answer. But
why do I have to, I mean, the only recourse we have right now is for me to take Joe's numbers, file a Freedom of Information Act with NARA and say, where are these documents? That's just to find the documents, then to figure out how to, and what they're going to send me. They're going to send me PDFs. First they're going to say if these documents exist, where they are. And so we don't, it's so archaic to think that we have to go to a government agency and talk to someone to pull up these records and then discover how, I mean, it just seems in the 21st century, the idea that someone could do a query and say, where was Bob and Larry in 1975 and, you know, May 14th of 75? Were they in the same state, the same town, the same room? I know the answer, but.
I just want to add one other comment. I was thinking about the scope of what we're trying to accomplish, but, you know, on an everyday basis, you've got literally hundreds of PhD economists that do this routinely. Those are particularly in academia, those that are doing research, they, in terms of relational databases, when they're trying to find correlations, they're looking at causation and all of that. They're knee deep in this type of stuff. And
how they crunch the numbers?
Oh yeah. And the power of the computers in some cases that they have to use are mind blowing. I mean, but there are a lot of guys out there that are doing this type of stuff.
And to your point, Brooks, the size of these projects has a scalability issue. I mean, it's not necessarily linear that if you double the size of the database or you double the number of relationships that you need twice as much computing. You may need five times as much computing. So all of those things are all components. And then again, I am looking at the chat, and I don't know Peter Trudell, but he made the comment, and you know, I overlooked this, that the license for MySQL is owned by Oracle. It's just
really?
But they just make this version. You might argue that for Oracle, it's a lost leader. I mean, I think there was a time when Oracle was the richest company in the U.S.
Then in Sun Microsystems, right? They were the two leading.
Well, Sun and certainly Microsoft was up there. But in any event, MySQL tends to be targeted toward the lower end, which suggests that it's like a lost leader role. So you get people hooked. But when I say people, probably businesses hooked. And then when they scale, their scalable direction is to now a product that would profit the original vendor.
It's like GM selling you a Chevy, and then you decide to buy a Pontiac, and then an Oldsmobile, a Buick, right?
So this, in this hour discussion, we've probably tackled a dozen moving parts. I would offer that there's 10 times as many moving parts that may come into the conversation if this gets legitimized in any way for Project JFK or for...
Brooks, is your point that because there are likely very powerful systems being used by economists, you know, the Fed and everybody else, that the odds of us coming up with something that would be investable is probably not very high, and therefore we should be thinking about more foundations or just raising money as a non, you know.
I think you've got two things here. You've got the concept of what it is you're trying to accomplish, and then the actual... The mechanism itself is highly customized. You know, to build a foundation, the platform on which you're going to analyze this data. I don't know from one project to the next, and Bob can weigh on this and Mark. I think as you go project to project, that degree of customization becomes a burden. You know, so what you're trying to market is a long way from turnkey.
So from my non-technical lawyer idea, so that whatever we build for this project may not be have applicable uses for some other project, because you have to customize it for that particular, just like we have issues with numbers, right? You know, some other projects can have different complications.
And As a poorly chosen set of metaphors, you might think of a relational database core product as a box of Legos or Tinker Toys. All the pieces are there. You just have to figure out how to put them together to achieve your objective. And to Brooke's comment about the art, the metaphor may apply there because you could pull together Lego bricks that look like Lego bricks, or you could make it into the Taj Mahal. And so to that point, if you do construct the JFK Taj Mahal, is it applicable to anything else? Probably not until you move some bricks around. So this whole thing is based on the relationships that are relevant to the objectives that are trying to be achieved.
It might not even be relevant to the RFK assassination, right?
That may be different. I don't know. I don't have enough knowledge. I think David wants to break this conversation up. I don't blame him.
He's looking bored.
Well, I'm saying we're rounding what the 3.5 hour mark. I want to share this real quick. This was from Doug Campbell.
Oh, that's right. We never got to that.
I don't want to skip over it. I mean, he took and did a side comparison here. Now, this was the photograph that Larry was showing a while ago that was in the Sforzani book. And, I mean, Doug can't actually talk at the moment with his microphone, so that's why he sent it to me, and I'm showing it to you guys. But from what I'm picking up here, it's not the same guy. The watch is on a different hand.
And I went and looked at other pictures of Phillips to see if maybe it was flipped. But, hey, don't forget that I have a disclaimer. I said this was Gainis, okay? I never said it was coming from me. All right.
Well, yeah, and what Doug's point was Gainis had got it wrong. And if it was a flip picture, then of course his hairline would be on the opposite side. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm just relaying what Doug had sent me. I guess food for thought. So, but yeah, you're right. It did come from Gaines's book. So,
left-handed people put their watches on their right hand.
Well, I mean, I'm right-handed, and I've always worn my watch on my, left hand. But I see people that are right-handed, and they put their watch. I mean, I've tried it both ways, and it bugs the shit out of me to have my watch on my dominant hand. It just does.
Yes, yes.
There's another phenomenon that's been driving that, and that's these Fitbit-type watches.
Yep.
People have put them on their dominant hand because they feel that it gives them a better reading. But I agree with David. It drives me crazy to put my watch on my dominant right hand. So I think that's the intuition that most people have. But
unless you're left-handed because you want to have the Fitbit closest to your heart.
I'm right-handed. So of course, having it on my left hand on my left wrist, that's the arm that's close to my heart. But and they always say, hey, if you're going to have a heart attack, you're going to have it down your left arm. So, I sure as hell want to know when my blood pressure gets above what it should be in my heart rate. So, but yeah, hey, thanks, Doug, for the photograph, and the comparison. But yeah, I think we've discussed, a lot of key points today. I feel like we had a great meeting, and anytime that Bob can join in and give us some food for thought. And I mean, hell, he's designed a lot of stuff and he's very knowledgeable. And I think, this gives me key points in the fact of, what I'm working on with, the Russell collection. Everything is getting scanned in everything's been scanned now. They're all individual TIFF images, but you can't search a TIFF image. I mean, you can, I guess, but you're looking at having somebody open up, if there's 500 pages to, one folder, they've got to sit there and open up all 500 pages to read through everything. So I'm converting everything into searchable PDFs to start with. Or I guess the next step, because they're already scanned in as TIFFs. They're going to searchable PDFs next. And I know that Baylor's going to put them online, and they wanted their system to, they want us to scan them in as TIFF images. So, but I think it's going to be a little more streamlined with searchable PDFs. I'm sorry, what was that, Larry?
Why would they want to do that?
It could be the fact that's how their search engine is built at the college.
Okay.
How they input the individual images and the data. But I mean, when you're looking at, like I said, we scanned 56 boxes. I cannot remember the amount of folders that there is. But I'm just sitting there going, okay, there is, you know, there's a lot of information there, a lot of documents, a lot of individual images. And my idea to start with is to take each folder, you know, you have your box, that's your folder box. And then inside each one of those is a separate folder that will contain the, you know, the PDF for folder one, folder two, and so on per that box. You know, that's the easier way, because I mean, the way the folders are set up is by topic. So, you know, the next stage is once they're converted into searchable PDFs, then that's where the searchable part of it will be, where you can go in and go into 3 to 4 depth on your search bar in order to figure out, you know, what's in the collection as a whole, and then trace it down to what's in, you know, where you're going to go to, which folder, you know, which box that information is in, and then so on. So,
from a technological point of view, David, what's happening there with PDFs that's now available because of the rapidly increasing speed of computers is those documents are in fact pixelated images in a way, just a simplistic way. But what's going on is optical character recognition, OCR. So they are actually converting what's in these scannable documents into something you can search. The other thing about GIFs, PDFs, I'm sorry, not PDFs, JPEGs, PNG files, is that what tries to approximate that searchability is the use of metadata. Now, yeah. Metadata has to be populated, and it obviously can't even come close. I mean, like with the photos that you showed, how would you put metadata in to characterize those two? And then the third thing is, do you happen to know, or does anybody know, whether the Russell Foundation is in fact using any kind of database technology or methodology under the covers to help them manage their wealth of data? Do you know that?
I don't know what Baylor, it's not Russell, it's Baylor University itself. I don't know what, I don't know what's underneath the hood, so to speak, of their vehicle of getting all the information available. I know if you get a chance, go onto a Baylor's website and look at their collections that they have digitized, and just, you know, give it a look around and okay. Give me your opinion on that, Bob.
Okay, I'll try to remember to do that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave, do you think that, do you know whether the Hood University is, are they still accepting materials, or do you think this is a one-time thing with Weisberg's collection?
You know, to be honest, I don't know. I mean, I know there's a lot of universities, you know, I call them basically depots for documents and collections. And I know that, when I spoke to Baylor, this was last year, they were actually looking at creating, you know, more open space. And like we talked about, you know, months ago,
open space, there's physical open space or technologically open?
Physical open space. You know, it used to be like, you know, I'm just saying for Baylor for one, like the Armstrong collection, Dick Russell's, Jack White. You run out of physical space after you house so many collections in your archives. I know, you know, the way that Project JFK has been doing it, you know, Brian's got his archives, Casey has his at his house, I have mine at my house. And then now that we're starting to get, you know, people that want to donate to us, then it's going out and getting a physical, you know, location, to house the physical part of it. Once it's digitized, it's not a big deal.
I'm wondering, like, again, going back to this relational idea, it might be that a place that has a collection on the Kennedy assassination, they obviously are constrained by space now. Maybe they'd be interested in having this kind of relational database that would help them free up space but still maintain a collection that, you know, and maybe we could then build on that collection with them because we're not adding to more physical space to them.
Right. I mean, it's like with Dick's collection. I mean, we were shipped the collection, we scanned it, and then we shipped all the boxes back because they wanted to hold the physical you know, part of their, you know, deed of gift with Dick Russell was to, you know, house the collection for him. And I know I've got other researchers that have, you know, contacted me and said, hey, I would like to have my collection digitized. And I always ask them, do you want us to house the collection, or do you want to have us digitize and then send everything back to you? I'm at the point where, you know, either way, it needs to be, you know, there needs to be a caretaker for it. And when and nothing bothers me more when I hear of a library or a, you know, an institution that says, well, we've had this for 20, 30, you know, 58 years, but we just don't have the room for it no more. So, of course, it's their option, it's their discretion what they're going to do with it. And whether it's been digitized or not digitized, we lose, you know, if they choose to, you know, chuck it into file 13 in the dumpster or send it out to the shred service, we lose that opportunity to be able to, you know, access those files later on.
But I'm wondering, like, it may be that in the future that universities might only accept deeds of gifts if they're not obligated to maintain them physically, right? I mean, you know, they digitize
right.
And then who needs the physical anymore? You know, I mean, I'm thinking out loud, but that might be a trend as these places get time, space constrained.
Well, I know a lot of the people that, you know, are becoming minimalists, me being a minimalist, shit, good luck with that. I have too much stuff, but, you know, a lot of people, they digitize their CDs, their LPs, their books. They live in tiny houses. And that's great. I have not a problem with that at all. But, you know, eventually what happens when you have things digitized and you have a hard drive crash? It's not saved to the cloud. There's only so much. I mean, it depends on, you know, cost wise, how much online cloud storage are you going to have? You know, what's going to be available? What can you afford?
I have a zip drive that is not working anymore, and I have files on that. I don't know how to recover them.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, the you know, the companies that are out there that you can, you know, you have a hard drive that's failed. I mean, I've had hard drives, flash drives, SD cards and become corrupt. You know, it's a real pain in the ass when you send it to them. They take their time to get it done, sometimes more time than what you think it should take. And you get that reply back, well, we just couldn't recover the information. That's the last thing you want to hear. You
that's
know?
All too so common.
Having,
yeah, my advice to people with critical data is free copies.
Yeah.
And
well,
one of them should not be in the same physical location where your computing equipment is. Because I've had people who have, you know, I have a backup drive on the same table with my computer, and then I had a bunch of other drives, and they were all sitting in the room, and if my house burned, I'm screwed. So I actually made copies and gave them to a girlfriend, and she's got them in her place. And a lot of people don't think about this at all. So it's a very powerful notion that you're promoting here, David.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know the way that I've ran. I mean, I know Brian had a hard drive, and it you know, corrupted. Had no physical damage, but it just eventually they run a shelf life. And what I do is, you know, I create a drive, and then I make an immediate backup. The immediate backup doesn't get touched for the first, you know, year or two. But when the time I hit the three-year mark, I'm buying another drive, and then I put them in rotation. That drive, I'll use it till it quits. I have some drives that I've been using for 10 years, 15 years. They still work perfectly fine, but I know that it's a crapshoot. You plug it in one day, and it's just not going to be there.
And you know, the other thing that catches people is this notion that DVDs and CDs have infinite longevity, and they have very short lifetimes. They
yeah.
actually no longer work. And depending on the quality of your product, pick a year, but some, as soon as 3 years, some 5 years, some 10 years, they're no longer functional.
Yeah, I tell people all the time that, you know, because I digitize, you know, home movies, photographs for people, and I always suggest, you know, yes, I can put it on a flash drive, you can access it immediately. But I also go back to the fact of, you know, M-Disc, because M-Discs are way better than standard CDRs or DVD-Rs. But then, of course, you know, if you have the storage space, put it in the cloud, you know. Unfortunately, the cloud's not as secure as what people think it is. You know, I've never personally had my stuff, you know, hacked in the cloud, but we know several celebrities with their sex tapes have, so it's only as secure as you can make it. So, you know, I suggest people, like, when it comes to this stuff, keep the physical copy. You can always I mean, yes, it's time-consuming as hell, but you can always go in and rescan a physical collection, you know. And then, like Bob was saying, I mean, when I have, you know, hard drives, I rotate out. I have 2 to 3 copies of each hard drive, and I have things stored in multiple locations, just so that way if one fails, you've got backups. So there's nothing worse than, you know, thinking, oh, it's on my laptop, and I'm great because I've got 2 drives, and I'll put it on the storage part of the drive. Well, partitions wear out. Drives wear out. Mishaps happen. I think we had, like I said, we had a great discussion, and we'll see everybody back next month. And I'm looking at trying to get some spotlight people, spotlight programs set up. You know, later, I'm hoping we can have one later this month. I like say, if anybody has a way to reach out to Abraham Bolden, I think it'd be great to get him on the record, kind of a on Zoom living oral history of what took place in his life and then where he's at today now with the pardon coming. So, well, not coming, it's already here. So, I want to thank you guys, especially the 14 that still held on. And, you know, without you guys, we wouldn't have anything to get together and talk about. So appreciate it.
Larry, to answer your comment, reach out to me. I can probably help you with the SIPRA.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Well, again, thanks again, everybody. And we will see you, next month, if not sooner. And remember to check out the YouTube channel, hit the subscribe button, comment, leave a thumbs up or a thumbs down, whichever you know are in the mood to do at that time. And keep checking out the website. There's stuff that's always changing and getting added to. So with that, thanks again, everybody, and we'll see you as soon as we can.
Thanks for keeping the flame burning, David. We appreciate it.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.